KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. All right, there you have it. It's Mike Hagan. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, right here in Mid-Missouri, coming to you live from 915 East Broadway, downtown Columbia. A big thank you to Corey with New Wave Radio Theater, doing some interesting stuff for us again tonight. Come on in, Corey, if you want. It's no big deal. Anyway, Corey, big news tonight. The Night Blooming Sirius. Corey just told me she has this plant. It's called a Sirius. Now, the name alone, you know, sparks my interest, but it's spelled C-E-R-E-U-S. But this is a plant that only blooms once a year, one night of the year. And tonight is the night, at least for Corys. So here's to it. Must be something special going on tonight, because the Night Blooming Sirius is doing exactly that. So here's to you, Cory, and to your lovely blooming plant. Corey's out in the lobby there waving her hands at me. She's probably going to run home and take some photos, put them up on the web. Okay, anyway, doing New Wave Radio Theater. Corey, you've been sitting in for the last few weeks. We'll see if she sticks around or not. Before that, Kelvin and Jason Do It Up. Jazz plus blues equals signs in the heavens. Tech Radio keeps us up on the remarkable world of high technology. Jeff Wheeler, always starting things off with Uncommon Light. 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday, good music, good talk, good news. Cosmic Cool Radio on a crescent moon Monday. KOPN Columbia, your imagination station, glad to be here with you and a part of it all. All right, thanks very much to all of you who joined in last week. And a big thank you to Kent Daniel Benkowski for a revealing discussion about the events of September 11th, 2001. 9/11, still high on my radar, whether it's on anybody else's or not. Regardless, an interesting program last week. We also heard music from Bartholomew Bean. Bart, one of the local troubadours around town here, got a lot of nice comments about the music last week. Information about all the musicians I feature on the program can be found on the web, by the way, at my site in the music archives. Good music happening all around Columbia and mid-Missouri these days. And tonight we'll have the music of Calhoun. And although they're not a Missouri band, they're a band I saw a couple weeks ago from Dallas-Fort Worth area, and I thought I'd share their music with y'all tonight. We'll hear Calhoun songs throughout the program tonight. We started things off with a song called These Are the Dead Days, and we'll hear another one from them in just a few minutes here. If you missed last weekend's, if you missed last week's show, I should say, or any other for that matter, you can always hear them after the fact. They're all on the web, www.mikehagan.com is the place you can go to find them. Just click on over to the program archives. You can check out last week's show and see what you think. Share it with others if you get the notion, okay? All right, tonight, Mr. Rush Allen and Mr. Bruce Raphael. If you're a frequent listener to the program, then you probably couldn't have helped but hear at least one of the shows we've done with Bruce over the last 5 months or so. He was with us in April, again in July, and tonight joined by one of his mentors and co-researchers, the brilliant Mr. Rush Allen. We'll be discussing in further detail the so-called Lionsgate cosmology, which Rush and Bruce have been teasing out of a myriad of mythological and historical references, archaeological finds, astronomical discoveries. It is a fascinating tale and one that is highly relevant right now, today. As a quick aside, one of the main reasons I've spent so much time on this topic over the last few months is because this particular line of thought holds that the year 2007 is actually a very important year. And this is something that I have felt intuitively in my own life as well, and I've been compelled to continue to pull on this thread. So anyway, we're going to get things going with them in just a few minutes here, but first a quick ID and a song to get things going. By the way, welcome back to Bruce. Bruce Raphael has been in, I think he's been in China for at least 2 years. We'll let him tell us about that when he gets on the air here. But regardless, welcome back to Bruce. It's good to talk with him tonight in America. So we'll play a song here and come back with Mr. Rush Allen and Mr. Bruce Raphael, and we will talk about some very interesting ideas. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Welcome back to Bruce Raphael. This one's called The Edge of the Earth.
took it. You could have it, obey, you commit. We fall off the edge of the earth. We learn what's real. And now we have feelings. Heart that was yours, ain't a plan, ain't a scam. It's a gift. You could have it, obey, you commit. We fall off the edge of the earth. We learn what's real.
You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
That's right, it is Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. And let's get on with the business of this evening, all right? Okay, we've got two guests with us this evening. Bruce Raphael on the East Coast, Rush Allen on the West, and Radio Orbit set smack in between them here in Columbia, Missouri. So without any further delay, we'll say hello and welcome to Mr. Rush Allen, and hello and welcome back to Mr. Bruce Raphael. Hi, guys.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, Mark.
I'm great. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, hey, Rush. Nice to hear your voice from the other side of the country.
I don't know what I sound like, but I hope it's okay.
You're sounding good. It's actually wonderful that we do have both of you on here. Like we say, one from the east, one from the west, me in the middle, and we got the technology worked out, and I'm real pleased to have both of you here tonight. So, look, Bruce, what I'd like to do first, because the listeners are unfamiliar with Rush, I'd like to begin by giving him a few minutes to introduce himself and tell us a bit about himself and maybe draw a frame around what we'll be talking about tonight, and then we'll get you to hop in, and off we'll go. All right?
Sure. Yeah. Definitely. Rush Allen must have his name known, and let him speak up, because I know he has a few things he'd like to say tonight.
Okay. Well, let's do that, Mr. Rush Allen. If you would, please, a little bit about yourself, and say hello to everybody out here listening.
Well, hello, Missouri, and the rest of the country. This is my first time, so bear with me. While we're on the subject of stars, you might want to know, Mike, that the mouth of Quetzalcoatl is going overhead right now.
Is that right?
In what, St. Louis.
In what constellation is Quetzalcoatl?
Well, the constellation would be the constellation of Cygnus, the swan.
Ah, yes, yes,
and,
yes.
But in that constellation or beyond that constellation is the Milky Way, and there is a dark rift in the Milky Way that is the mouth of Quetzalcoatl.
Hmm.
And the Mayas basically saw that as a sign of the mother. And it's also, Quetzalcoatl was also a place for Tiamat. Tiamat was the mother of time in Egypt.
Hmm.
But interestingly enough, as we pass through this little three-hour period, we will come to a ladder. And it is what's called Jacob's Ladder.
Yes.
And it's the so-called tree, the world tree in the sky. Mm-hmm. That's where we'll end the program.
Amazing.
And if we were to look down from St. Louis or from Columbia, what we'd see is during that three-hour period, the lion, Leo, will pass underneath. And so within the next hour, your meridian will pass into the lion's mouth, and you will go through the lion's gate. And if Bruce has anything to do with it, he will reveal, you know, the fundamental story that he's been working up for quite a few years now.
Remarkable.
And
Rush, I'll just add this for my listeners out there, but it's been really weird because last Monday was a new moon, and there was also a solar eclipse. And 2 weeks before that, on Monday, was the previous full moon in August, of which there was a full lunar eclipse. So for whatever reason, the gods have been smiling upon Radio Orbit, because the three out of the four Monday nights that we've had in the last 4 weeks have been just remarkable setups in the sky as well.
Yeah, these things tend to happen, you know, if you're alert to them. And in fact, the lunar eclipse was an interesting thing. I was sleeping. I woke up about 2:30, 3 o'clock. No reason I could think of. And then I was, you know, thinking, oh, if I can't sleep, I might as well get something done. I'm an engineer, so I want to get one of my reports out. I work out of my home, so
right.
I went upstairs. And while I was up there, I said, I wanted to see something about the stars, because Bruce and I have been discussing something. So I took a look at Anaheim, California, which is where I am, near Disneyland. And I looked up, and I said, well, that's funny. The moon looks kind of peculiar over there. So I pulled my star chart up, and I zoomed in on the moon, and sure enough, the moon was behind the shadow. I said, whoa, wait a minute. And so I ran downstairs, and I went outside in the front door. I looked in the street, and sure enough, the moon was blocked. I had no idea there was an eclipse going on.
Amazing.
Anyway, I wrote up a story on the whole thing. It was a phenomenal experience. I even woke up my wife, had her come out and look at it. She saw it. And then the next day, we saw Venus rise in the east.
Mm.
It was the morning star. But something happened that night that just, well, you have to be at this for 40 years to understand why it blew me away. But I looked up in the backyard, and I said, well, you know, there's the moon, and near the moon is the planet Uranus. And I said that Uranus is a planet you can actually see with the naked eye, if you have clear air. Of course, New York and California, we have too many lights to see Uranus.
Right.
But there in Columbia, you might be able to see it.
Sure.
Anyway, I went out and I sat in my backyard and I looked around and I found got my orientation, knew where the stars were. Of course, I knew where the moon was because it was still, you know, in the shadow. It was kind of a
red moon.
Right, you
can still see it. Right.
And then I put on my binoculars so I could get through the Los Angeles air, and I saw three stars. And I said, well, you know, that's right on the cup of Aquarius, and that's where Uranus is. So I looked around, and I found two other stars that I knew of in the cup of Aquarius, and then a third star. And I said, what is that? And I went back up, looked at my star chart, and sure enough, it was the planet Uranus. Now, to understand Uranus from my perspective, you have to recognize that Uranus, Uranus, Geb, Happy, all the ancient gods that had to do with the beginning of time, he was the first father. He was the father of time itself.
Hmm.
So on a mythical basis, the father of time is the initiator of time. Saturn, of course, is the lord of time. Saturn is the one who consumes all its children.
And this is the Greek Kronos, right?
Right, the Greek Kronos. And of course, we all know that time consumes youth.
Hmm.
And if anybody doesn't believe that, just wait.
Yeah, I'm 43, and I already recognize it pretty clearly. So,
but anyway, I looked. I said, "Wow, that's amazing." That's why I was awakened, because I had been wanting to see Uranus. I had discovered on the Denver Zodiac that Uranus was in a central position, and I realized that Uranus was visible to them 2,000 years ago. And to the people who looked at the stars back in those days, they would never have allowed a star to come into view without recording it.
Hmm.
And so they knew Uranus was there, and not only did they know it was there, they noticed where it was. It was at the top of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the Father of Time was ascending into heaven. In mythological terms, this is as big as it gets.
Right.
That is what is the essence of the Denver Zodiac. It's marking the moment when the Father of Time returned to heaven. So,
Rush, what kind of an engineer are you?
Let me back out now that I've given you the introduction.
Yeah.
To scare everybody away.
No. They're jumping in. Trust me. People love this stuff, and people have been really looking forward to it. So.
I'm a good engineer.
A good engineer. Wow, that's actually I've been in manufacturing for many years, and there aren't that many of you.
Well, I mean, I'm a rebellious type. I basically couldn't get along with the political structure where I work, so I went out on my own.
Uh huh.
And of course, after starving to death for a while, you finally learn the ropes, and then you learn how to make a living at it.
Right.
But I've got a 3 engineering degrees and a master in business administration.
Mm-hmm.
And basically I'm trained as an electrical engineer. I'm a professional engineer in mechanical, electrical, and control systems, and I sell those services in Southern California or wherever I can get somebody to buy them.
Right, okay.
And anyway, it's an analytical type service that I provide. The spinoff of all that analytical stuff was that sometimes when I'm bored and work is low, I would dig into the mythological stories.
How did you discover the Denver Zodiac, I guess?
And let's go back before the Denver Zodiac, because I wouldn't have discovered it had I didn't have the previous 10 or 20 years.
I tell you what, how about if I ask you how you met Bruce? And maybe that, or you can fit that in the story, okay?
Yeah, that will go in. So basically, I went looking for somebody to talk to about this stuff.
Okay.
And I found Bruce out there. He was looking for the World Tree, and I said, hey, you need some help.
How long ago was this?
I don't know, Bruce, 8, 10 years?
Yeah, 10 years. I think it was around 96.
Okay, so 10, 11 years.
Somewhere in that ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
I set up Trilomnet in 1997, so it was probably the following year, maybe 98.
Okay.
But anyway, it was a situation where I had already put in, from 1966 until 1996, I had been, just kind of observing things as they came, so to speak. And there's an interesting book out there that got me started. It's a book called The Stars by H.A. Rey.
Hmm.
And it's a book written for young adults, teenagers, although teenagers probably wouldn't spend time on it. But what it allows you to do is you can take a little book and you can, he connects the dots, and so you can actually see the asterisms and the names that associate with the asterisms start to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in Boston at the time. And I had a little 914 Porsche, and my lady friend and I would hop in the car, take off the roof, and drive up into the wilderness of Massachusetts, where the sky was clear. And we'd sit there, and we'd park, and, whatever. And looking up at the sky, we'd notice the stars, and both of us were kind of into what the stars were doing. And
sure.
Many times we would actually see an event going on in the sky. I mean, we would say something, and then, boom, a flash of light would go across the sky.
Huh.
And I said, hey, wait a minute, the sky's trying to talk to me.
Right.
And, of course, once you get into that frame of mind, you're open. Okay, and the door opens, and this is part of the Lionsgate, that you've got to let your imagination witness the communication, because it's going to come in a cosmic sense. It's just going to be an event.
Mm.
And you don't want to intuit it. You want to let the event happen. Then you want to try to figure out if it's related to you.
Mm.
And quite often what you'll find out after doing this now for over 40 years, what you find out is you can think a thought, and then the stars will move in response to your thought.
Now,
you're not controlling the stars, but something out beyond the stars is controlling them, saying, here I am.
Or they are responding individually to your own thoughts or something.
Well, I would say it, you know, after 4 years, it goes much bigger than that. It gets scary when you hear it from my perspective, but basically let's go back to the Father Time individual. The stars are where they are on purpose.
Hmm.
They have been moved into position to tell a story that can only be told around our sun. And it's a story especially for a place called Solomon. Now, Solomon means Saul of sun, man is man. So
yes.
The son of man is our star, Saul. And that place, if you read the stars by connecting all the dots and reading the constellations, you have a background for communication.
Mm.
And then the story just goes from there.
You know,
anyway, I put all this together, and then I went to a program that went on down in Washington called The Return to the Source. And John Anthony West and Boval and Hancock, all those guys were down there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they were putting on a program. And it was really intriguing. And one gentleman there, Frank Brest, put on a story showing the Hall of Bulls in Lascaux. And he connected the animals in the Hall of Bulls to the sky from, let's say, Gemini all the way over to Scorpio through Virgo.
Wow. And, Rush, for those unfamiliar, we're talking about, in Lascaux, we're talking about the caves in France. Is that correct?
The Lascaux Cave in France, a 30,000-year-old.
Right, right. Neolithic, high Neolithic caves, yeah.
Right.
Okay,
with
amazing paintings and things on the walls and things. Okay.
Yeah, it was mind-boggling. Of course, I have been doing it now for nearly 30 years when I saw what he did, and I says, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody at the program thought it was great, but I don't know what happened to Frank. He just kind of disappeared off the face of the earth, and he never got much publicity for what he discovered.
What was his name again?
I said Frank Brest, but it's not Brest. I'll have to get the name.
Anyway, I was just curious. I was trying to track him down, that's all. Anyway.
But anyway, the name will come to me eventually. That's one thing about watching stars. You just don't pick up on names.
No, it doesn't.
Could I mention something here, guys?
What's that, Bruce?
Just for the reference to the caves, in the story about the modern cave dwelling that I put at Cyberspace Orbit.
Right, right, right.
If you go to the list, there's modern cave dwelling or are we ready for cave life? And if you scroll down, there's a story that interlocks with, you know, life in caves, and there's a picture there that Rush and I co-created anyway. And there's some story about that. So, you know, if you follow this tonight, you're going to be very interested in how, you know, we've covered this this article, I guess, came out a few months ago. But it dealt with the idea that ancient man was quite familiar as far back as 30,000 years, if not more, how his connection to the stars meant something every day. You know, it wasn't just like, oh, let's go out on a clear night. Every day there was something important. So I just thought I'd mention that. It's called Cave Life and Extinction Timelines Revisited, May 24th.
Right, and I'll mention the website in general for everyone to take a peek at. It would be very helpful to probably follow along there on the on the site. If you go to my homepage there at mikehagan.com and just click over to the main page, scroll down and you will see a link there right under Bruce Raphael and Rush Allen's name. It says Lionsgate Cosmology Part 3. If you just click on that link, it'll take you over to a special page that Kent Stedman has put together over at cyberspaceorbit.com. A great job by Kent, by the way, putting all this stuff together. And anyway, you can follow right along with us as we get deeper into it tonight, okay? All right, so, Rush, back to you and the continuation here.
But anyway, the key in terms of the communication is to recognize that the ancients, beyond about 5,000 or 10,000 years ago when writing was first invented, used images, and they basically communicated in patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And there's work been done in the Scientific American, published in August 1975 or 1978, I forget which, in which they showed that the birds recognized the patterns in the stars, and they would follow those stars and go from North Pole to South Pole. In other words, they were navigating by the stars. Oh, by the way, the answer to your question on the gentleman's name was Frank Edge.
Frank Edge?
Yes.
Wow, great name.
At any rate, the important point is to realize that the birds migrate by the stars. Most of the animals will recognize patterns in the stars, and thousands and maybe millions of years ago, certainly tens of thousands, certainly at least 30,000, because they were drawn in a cave at Lascaux.
Right.
Human beings were recognizing the patterns.
Okay.
And there's a very valid reason for it. The birds migrate with the seasons, and of course the human beings migrate with the animals and with the seasons.
Hmm.
So, at any rate, what was opening up when I started to recognize these patterns is I could read the myths in the sky that they were talking about.
You know, it's important, I think, to point out again that you made a mention of the fact that this is only something that works from our perspective here on Earth and from our solar system. In other words, the perspective is all important in the way that the heavens are set up.
Yeah, it would be like if you were sitting in a forest, okay, and looking at trees in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody starts describing the forest that he sees in California, wouldn't be the same forest.
Right.
And so in our little globe, if you will, our sphere, the stars are basically around the solar system. And so that the stars that the myths describe are the stars of the solar system. They can't describe stars, you know, the constellations around Alpha Centaurus or Deneb, or some other great star.
Right.
Because it'd be a different set of constellations. You would have different angles. The patterns would all be different.
So we truly are the center of the universe.
Well, we're the center of our universe. Right. But the most important thing, and this is the scary part for many people, is that, like I tell Bruce, I said, suppose that you were to take a box of marbles and throw them out, okay, a big bang,
mm-hmm.
okay, would there be any evidence of your intent to say anything if the marbles just went flying? It'd be all chaos. But the ancients said, well, if the stars are chaos, then there would be no pattern. So they looked, and they found the pattern, and they found messages that basically told them everything they need to know about life.
Hmm.
And the question is whether the stars told them that, or whether the fact that they opened up their minds and that told them that isn't so relevant. What they ended up doing was they worshiped life so much that they connected every single star into a set of patterns. And that pattern is what was handed down from Egypt from its very founding. The founding of Egypt, you know, to today, the constellations that Egypt had, most of our constellations are still the ones they use.
What about the people that say, well, it was just something that the human mind drew up there in the heavens, and that you could draw a bull anywhere you wanted if you picked out the right stars?
The answer is very simple, Mike. Suppose you went into Denny's, okay, and you're a kid, and they give you a child's menu, and there's a little pattern of dots on there.
Hmm.
Now Denny's numbers them for you. So you draw a line and line and line, and it comes out, hey, look, it's a rabbit. No, it's a coincidence. It just looks like a rabbit. And see, that's what you have to do. Once you connect all the dots, and you get the pattern the ancient people had, and then you'll see the world they saw, then you'll say, well, it is a chance.
Right.
In their opinion, it couldn't be chance, because you couldn't put all these things together in the pattern that is there without there being somebody manipulating those stars.
Okay.
And that's powerful stuff. I mean, it is really powerful stuff once you let that sink in.
Right.
That somebody is telling the stars to go somewhere. Now, it took them 15 billion years. Okay, so what? The so-called Lion's Gate that Bruce talks about, this isn't a forever thing. I mean, it's long compared to us. But if you go back 25,000 years, the pattern of the stars in Leo didn't make a lion. And the pattern of the stars in Gemini didn't make twins. If you go another 25,000 years from today, they won't make the patterns they have today. So we're in a window in which the heavens are saying, if you want to talk to me, I'm here.
Now's the time.
And, you know, that's the message. And, of course, that message is good for a period of probably about 25,000 years. So we can go back. And we can actually go back far enough that we find out that some of the old people didn't have the same stars, like if you go back to Lascaux. You're almost far enough back that they wouldn't have seen a lion.
Hmm.
But they were, as you mentioned before, they were prone to see certain things. For instance, they followed their aurochs. Those are the wild cows.
Right.
And so, naturally, what would they think of? They think of cows.
Hmm.
But when you look at the pattern in the stars that they drew on the white chalk in the Lascaux cave, you'll see all the cows are moving towards one point.
Hmm.
And the point they're moving towards is the constellation Cancer, and a place in there called the Beehive or Praesepe. In other words, that's the so-called birthplace at the mouth of the lion. It's where conception begins to the ancients. And so what it means is the cows were coming home. And it's an enormous, if you can feel it, you know, this is what they heard. This is where the cows come home.
Huh.
You know, and that would be, you know, an amazing thing. And, of course, back in those ages, the men were, let's just say, less structural than they are today. You know, there was still a matriarchal society 30,000 or 16,000, 17,000 years ago.
Yeah, I'm very interested in that high Neolithic, the cultures that existed back then. I'm interested in the shamanic cultures from way back and into today, as a matter of fact. So,
the cave at Lascaux is actually formed as the womb of a human female.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically, you go into that cave and you see where the cows come home, and then you come out of the cave and you're basically born again.
Mm-hmm.
Only now, instead of the heavens being on the wall inside the mountain, the heavens are now on the wall outside the mountain.
Mm.
And so it was a relationship that taught parents pass on to their children their traditions, their lifestyle, and basically the love of family. And that is the fundamental message you'll find when you read the stars and you connect the dots. You'll find that for thousands and thousands of years, human beings have loved to tell their children what they saw in the sky.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for that. That's a great way to get things going. Bruce.
Yes.
Thanks for being patient, too.
No. I think Rush set the parameters for me to launch into some very important things here.
Okay, I'll tell you what. Let's do that. Let's give the website again one more time. Again, if you go to my site at MikeHagan.com, just click right down to the link that says Lionsgate Cosmology, and then you can follow right along with us here. And thanks again to Kent for getting this up for us. And all right, Bruce.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Tonight is the night blooming Sirius. Now, when you look at this beautiful
Can you believe
flower,
that? That's my friend's flower. She told me she was all excited about it.
It's called the Queen of the Night. Now, if you look at this flower, it looks very queen-like, but it also does look like a swan.
Mm-hmm. It's white. It's beautiful, yeah.
It's white. It's got gold stamens. It's beautiful. And, you know, you don't need to know much that that hasn't been said before, but there's something that was said in this little blurb here that is quite interesting. It says, one of the strangest plants of the desert, right? It resembles nothing more than a dead bush. It is rarely seen in the wild because of its inconspicuousness. But for one midsummer's night each year, midsummer, well, it's different, its exquisitely scented flower opens as night falls and closes forever with the first rays of the sun.
Hmm.
Now, there's obviously a lot of storytelling there because, as we know, the story of Leda, the swan, and its relationship with Zeus is one which we could elaborate later. But just to know that the parameter of these flowers set on the stage of our show tonight is very significant. So thank you for that young lady who's participated with that cosmic reckoning.
That's amazing, because when I came in to see her about an hour ago, she said, Mike, it's a cosmic night. That's why she said, my Sirius is blooming. I said, what the hell is that? And she told me the whole story, and we got it up on the web, and we looked at pictures. It was amazing.
Well, another thing to bring into focus is that, you know, all this grew out of some seed that was planted around July 17th. And we know that the Lion's Gate opened up on many metaphysical levels at that time. So
right. You were on the air that night.
Yeah. Oh, wow, was I? Yes,
you were.
I was.
Yeah.
And so now, 90 days later, July 17th, write this down, go July 17, August 17, September 17, both numbers add up to 2-4, which is 6. So we are still in the mouth of the lion, 6-6, right?
Hmm.
You add that up, 6-6. Forget the 2007 for now. So what we got now is a format for us to sort of interpolate why we are even here. Why are we even bothering this? Because a lot of people who are metaphysically inclined may, you know, just fall into our imagination. But as you will note, that in the progression to go from part one to part three, we have to take readers sort of in a museum walk on what was what we think to be the most significant last call before the last New World Order was completed. And that was, if I'm not mistaken, around 48 B.C. when the Denver Zodiac was completed. And it took nearly a lifetime to assemble this magnificent mandalic kind of creation with its fine, you know, raised stone imagery, right, which would be similar to, you know, stenciling today with computers and lasers. So that sat in a temple 300 miles away from Giza, and its purpose was left as a secret, more or less. I mean, I'm sure many priests or famous, you know, icons of history maybe visited that place secretly. But what we brought to the public this way fulfills what I suggested in this last, on the Nera story, that I still believe that this is fulfillment of prophecy. That these stones had to, I mean, this stone is made of stone, and the rock that introduced more or less the bridge between Rush and I made a lot of sense to us back then, but it makes so much more sense now. Part of it is the fact that we had to sort of leave behind a lot of more or less scholastic procedures, you know, when you're trying to create some form of construct to understand archaeology and history and time. We actually, because we were giving over to cosmic intent in a way that is part of our story. I mean, it'll be in my book, and I'm sure it'll be in Rush's storyline, that to do this coherently gives you an ability to see yourself seeing yourself. So your imagination is completely able to witness things that just go beyond normal space-time reckoning. But because of our ability to be intelligent or well-educated, we've coalesced all this into a very terse, almost hard-to-read format. So people read that, and I say, well, read it again. And, you know, truthfully, even the most difficult, uneducated minds, when they read it and reread it, it becomes sort of like a mantra, right? And I'm not kidding, because, believe me, I have so many pages of Rush's notes and emails in the thousands that something took place after a while where you just got familiar, as like, as if you were a baby in the womb.
Yeah.
You know, it's all dark, but you knew your way around.
Mm-hmm.
So, my story...
I've had a similar experience, yeah.
Yeah, so you get the feel now that because you're part of this and we're sort of located at this important junction in time, our space, the way it's evaluated right now, is very, very, very important. So, you know, when we get to the discussion about China, or we get to discussion about more geopolitical things, you know, it sort of takes the feel away. But I've worked very hard to, as you can see through some of the stories, how there is some sort of way in which all cultures from the time, let's say, when the Zodiac more or less was turning the lights out on the old age and opening up the Piscean age, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to realize this is being repeated again. We're about to turn the lights off on Pisces, but that'll come at a great price, right? We are at a war of theocratic and theological constructs, and most people are starting to lose physical awareness of the background of the senses. That means that for those who are not even metaphysical or don't understand anything, you know, they rely on religion. But religion has become a little bit modified so that we don't really enter into the secret of this, as you will learn, what the City of Nine is about. It's more or less the sacred holy city that, you know, John and the other bits of Revelations reveals. So right now, hard to believe, this whole planet is being shrouded in this robe, right? So I'm able to speak very clearly that all the things that I've experienced and all the great sort of the gifts, of, they say the gifts of the Spirit, that have come through me are capable of entering into theological circles, you know, from Kierkegaard to Tillich, and now into, you know, even Rush Allen, who is certainly not a theologian, but he understands theology. And now it will come a time where I will have to, and I will be happy to meet with priests and rabbis of sorts, because unless they know that this is going on, they will be as foolish, you know, and cold as the pictures on the Denver Zodiac that no one will ever see in the Louvre. So it's time to sort of bring this out. the fact that, you know, we got caught in this sort of downdraft of information has been our field of vision. In other words, we've been swimming in this easily from the 17th, and we probably are far more aware of the responsibility, you know, of discussing this. So because of the, you know, the importance of revealing all these things that Revelations talks about, and, you know, that we go back to the nature of the beast. And all those who are listening to this show probably have heard enough from, you know, a variety of radio stations you listen to on the internet, whatever, you know, what this beast thing is about. And, you know, Rush and I have sort of coalesced or condensed it into a few things that, you know, it is part of a ancient yin-yang thing. You know, you have male-female, you know. But we're really talking about rational and irrational constructs or rational and irrational ways in which, you know, large masses of people are controlled, or in the way in which they want things, you know. And when you have this, you know, we are now in a position where, you know, consumption is seen as the means of revealing, you know, truth, right? The more you consume, you know, the more you have a chance to see more TV or more imagery that is created by our very own imagination. But the whole thing that Rush and I feel is that if there is meant to be some sort of way in which we can pull into a port of truth, you know, where you can dock your ship and really get a feed, a mainline feed, like your radio show provides, to get all the answers accurately, you know, this is the forum to do so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what Rush brought up about, you know, Quetzalcoatl has been argued by, you know, some professors that he and I crossed paths with, and they just don't see the you know, maybe it was a Quetzalcoatl with something else, but it could not be, you know, a star image. You know, it seems to be something of a archetype or, you know, an actual god guy, you know.
Right.
But Rush knows, and I know, that the patterns of history precast the characters who come about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, as Rush talked about, you know, Chrysippe, that beautiful little star cluster sort of in the grip of Cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just so happens that I was born, and this is sort of one of those hermetic secrets, but I was born in a town that was based around the beehive, right? The symbol is the beehive.
Amazing.
And I was born under the star of Regulus. And, you know, my cast and destiny was set well into gear, well before I could even be aware of it. But, you know, time is short. We're all going to have to, you know, produce something in this world. So this might be one of the things that I can produce. So, you know, all the cows come home, you know, into the beehive or where, you know, the manna of heaven is produced. This is what we're doing right now. The Lionsgate, more or less, grand finale is that it can produce manna, right? But also, as Rush knows, that the Lionsgate, you know, has that star value, as was written of all things, Revelations 9:11, that it's also Abaddon, you know, and sort of on a play in words, it's not necessarily always a good thing when you think of mana heaven. You also think of sort of like a negentropy, you know, something that's sort of opposite to what can be forecasted. It's almost like people who want to take down the truth. And so Regulus or Abaddon or, you know, Apollyon, the little lion, has a sort of measure of be careful, you know, what you wish for, you know. And we are in this whole age where, as you can see on the internet and stuff, you have a lot of doom and gloomers who know that they just can't wait for the whole darn picture to be signed out. Well, that won't happen, okay? It won't happen on the 21st of September, and it's not going to happen on October 31st. My guess is that any kind of future plan that will happen is definitely being held back by some much more powerful forces than, you know, military strategists.
Right.
And, you know, terrorists will think that they can pull off. I think we are definitely in very good hands right now, though everybody's very nervous. You know, and everyone's accusing everybody of hiding an agenda.
I was going to have Rush add his comment.
Yeah, I'd like to hear from him about this, because this Abaddon, Apollyon, is a very... it's an immovable star because it sort of was a sign that would forecast, you know, a change of precession and other things. So, Rush, maybe you can add something at this point.
Yeah, and let's, just for awareness, we've got about 6 or 7 minutes or so, and then we'll take a break at the top of the hour, okay?
Great.
All right.
But what Bruce is describing is what I would call the yang side of the picture. The yin side of the picture is the female side, if you will, the so-called irrational. And, you know, to understand the word irrational, you have to realize that just because it's irrational doesn't mean it's not true.
Hmm.
You know, love is irrational,
mm-hmm.
but nevertheless it's true.
Yes.
The key in the Lionsgate scenario that Bruce is, you know, advocating and I've decided to back him up on is that this transition, okay, if you want to call it Apollyon or Abaddon or Regulus, the regulator, little king, the important point is to realize that there are things going on today, worldwide things that are going on today, in which we see the Lion's Gate every time we turn on the news. You know, if we look at General Petraeus and you look at the flag that he stands before, and that flag shows a lion, okay, with a laurel wreath under the lion and a spear going through the lion.
Hmm.
And
wow.
This is the same lion.
Holy shit.
Okay, and it is the Lion's Gate. And the whole process is that, you know, 2,000 years ago, a transition occurred.
Rush, are these things happening just synchronistically, or do they actually know what they're doing when they put these things on the stage or behind the camera or whatever?
Well, the one who knows is not on the earth.
Right.
Okay. The bottom line is the Babylonian lion, okay, comes from Leo.
Hmm.
And if we go into Babylon, into Ur, into Baghdad, into any of those areas, we're going to see the Lion's Gate. We're going to see the Ishtar Gate. We're going to see that whole mythology that was described in Revelation come into life again.
Hmm.
And we have to realize that the other side of the Lion's Gate is the Demeter side, as opposed to the Zeus side or to the, you know, the Jupiter side or the Yang side.
And what's the significance of the other side?
Well, the significance is the question of whether it's rational love in terms of a man's point of view or irrational love in terms of a mother's point of view.
Mm, okay.
Okay, it's a question of whether the love is an affection love or a love that keeps you alive.
Mm.
Okay, a love that disciplines you and makes you do what you should do, a father love, or a love that gives you the sustenance to carry on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that comes at the middle of your darkest hour and puts you back on your feet again.
Mm-hmm.
This is the other side of the gate, but the real value of the Lion's Gate is, you know, what Bruce is saying, whether he, you know, sees it the way I do or not, you know, is not really relevant. What's relevant is that there is a moment in which you realize that something's being said and you are the one who is being said to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a moment of cognition. That's the so-called light in the road.
Mm-hmm.
We wander around and we're conscious all of our lives. But it's on a rare occasion we become conscious and we also realize there's something meaningful going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the essence of the last 7 years, if you will. I haven't put much thought into the 2007. Okay, I put a lot of time into 9/11,
mm-hmm.
and into what was going on, and I was still in the process of verifying the, let's just call it the sacred science of the Denver Zodiac. When I discovered the Zodiac, and then I started unraveling, I realized that this was a mandala of history. The whole history of man was put on one circle. And so I started to unravel what was there. And your last broadcast, by the way, triggered an enormous amount of revelation that I hadn't anticipated. And that's where the seven seals and most of what's in this website that Bruce has up here is coming from that spinoff from your last show.
Remarkable.
And I had gone through, there's a, on there, on that front page, there's three figures. The right figure shows the dendera trees. There are three trees, an 8-branch tree and 2 7-branch trees. And you can read the article and find out what they're about. But the important point is that the tree of life is on the dendera zodiac. And I mentioned to you before that when I first met Bruce, he was out looking for the world tree.
Mm-hmm.
And after your last broadcast, what I found was the world tree on the Tender Zodiac.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was perfectly synchronistic.
Just and absolutely amazing.
The key is synchronicity. You've got to have an open door, that's Lionsgate, to sense the synchronicity.
Right.
Let's back up on your introduction on the Sirius flower.
Mm-hmm.
And tonight is the blooming of the Queen of the Night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you only have to take you out of Sirius, and you have the Queen of the Night. Sirius was the name of Demeter in Rome. Sirius was the name of Virgo.
Yeah.
Sirius was the name of the combination of Leo and Virgo.
Remarkable.
And that's pretty synchronistic.
All right, we got another minute. Tell me a little bit about 9/11, and since we just passed the 6th anniversary just a week ago.
There's no way you can say a little bit about 9/11. 9/11 occurred exactly 2,000 years after the birth of Christ. And you have to know your count to realize it was exactly 2,000 years.
You know,
there was no year one in the original calendar.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. Could we talk a little bit about that after a break?
Sure.
Rush, Bruce, does that make sense to talk a little bit about that?
Fine. It would be to honor what we know as the Day of Judgment. So we have to put some term into that in this three-hour condensation. So by all means, So let's put some good music on and let's roll.
All right, we'll do it. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Okay, you guys?
How much time do I have?
You've got 4 minutes and 14 seconds.
Okay.
All right, everybody. We'll be back with Rush Allen and Bruce Raphael in just a few moments. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Pleasure to have Rush and Bruce with us again tonight. And we're getting deeper into this Lionsgate cosmology that we've been talking with Bruce about for the last 5 months. So very, very interesting and relevant stuff. And we'll continue it for the next couple hours here with Rush Allen and Bruce Raphael. In the meantime, a little bit of music here from my friends Calhoun. This one is called The Rain, The Stars. It's Mike, you listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
You left behind the good old days, and now
right, that's The Rain, The Stars from Calhoun. Music from Fort Worth, Dallas, Texas. And thanks for sharing the music with us all tonight, you guys. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. We've got Rush Allen and Bruce Raphael on the line. Bruce from Connecticut and Rush from out there in California. Great to have you both, and thanks for sticking around. Let's get back to it. We're going to talk a little bit about 911, and either one of you, whoever would like to jump in, go ahead.
Well, Bruce, why don't you, if you want to go ahead and do your perception of 9/11 and the Judgment Day thing.
Right. Well, you know, on the ground, there's always the facilitator that sort of sets things up so that you can appreciate. I mean, I was working down at the World Trade Center in those days, and prior, I mean, I always went through the building then, and I had the most bit of luck, I should say. About a week prior, a friend of mine and I, we had rented a car for some other reason. We drove around at night and looked at the towers in the dark with the light shining on it. It was pretty amazing. For some reason, most people probably have done it, but I had never done it. And 5 days before 9/11, I was working in that area, and I got the pink slip. You know, for some reason, I just didn't work out, and me and a few other people in the company were asked to leave. And of course, it was quite sad because, I don't know, it seemed like a great vision to have come from Australia and be back into the center of world trade, and it was just a wonderful feeling. And then, so all of us found other jobs pretty quickly, and then when the event happened, it was quite important to realize that, you know, we would have been inside that building easily. So that was a bit of a blessing, of course. But when it came to the cosmology and all that sort of thing, that was, of course, what Rush provided when he started to accurately present a star story, not so much in astrology, but just based on the stars themselves and how the story ticked off from, even I think we started at about sunrise, and then he walked us through.
And this is the stars as they were moving at that particular time.
Right, and when when Saturn, I think it was, and it was in, Saturn might have been in Gemini, Rush may have better memory, but the fact remains is that the most unusual thing is that when the whole event really started, Gemini, you know, the twins, were right over
the Twin Towers. Amazing.
I mean, that's a start. I mean, it goes beyond that, of course.
Right.
But that alone is enough to make you wonder, was that coordinated by, you know, the great Masonic mystics or what? But it happened just like that. And the story is far more validated, if you will, by understanding that the characters who, you know, we call asterism were actually doing an incredible cosmic dance for us to tell us exactly what what kind of chaos actually was going on in the heavens that sort of replicated what was going down here.
Huh.
So they were busy, I use this term loosely, so don't let the audience think I'm crazy, but they were busy up there doing this incredible story for us. And from all the, you know, mountain astrologer and stuff, I never got the feel that anybody got it except Rush. I don't know. You have to be able, like Shakespeare, to see what the characters are dancing on that stage.
Mm-hmm.
And Rush, you know, I don't know if he's got the template in front, but eventually, you know, we can focus in on that in a later story, which we didn't in any of these stories because it wasn't relevant at this time. But just to honor that, because you asked for it, I would say that when the towers collapsed, I'm not mistaken, Libra, it has something to do with the circumcision of Libra. Rush, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, do you remember that point on the, what is it called, that star, Zunica Zubazubi? Someplace with that. Something to do with the breakdown between Scorpio and Libra.
Mm-hmm.
There was some, just, I just can't remember it. It's just too vast. I didn't memorize it, but
well, the important point that, you know, the stars probably nobody understands, but they'll understand the idea that the men from Ur would come in judgment,
mm.
And, of course, Ur is a town outside of Baghdad.
Right, one of the earliest places that we've ever discovered as far as the modern civilization.
Right. And the men from Ur came in judgment on 9/11. And it's crystal clear that's why they were here. They came here to judge our society, and that we didn't fit into their scheme of righteousness. Mm-hmm. And so they came in judgment, and, you know, they had 19 guys who basically thought they could get to heaven by destroying, you know, some evil demons somewhere in the world. And, you know, that's a totally different thing. I mean, what got sacrificed, what got circumcised, as Bruce mentioned, was the idea that America is a land of virgins. That pristine nation that had no faults, all of a sudden, you know, was no longer a virgin. We lost our virginity on 9/11. And on that day, we basically had to decide whether we wanted to be grown up or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a tough day. And there's still a lot of people who don't want to grow up. They don't want to recognize, you know, the nature of life. But the judgment day scene and the circumcision, okay, of Libra. What you have to understand is that if you have the constellation Scorpio and Libra together, Libra was called the Claws, which meant it was one big constellation of a scorpion with enormous claws that reached all the way from the Milky Way at Sagittarius all the way to Virgo.
Uh-huh.
And the Book of Daniel discusses the splitting up of the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah, yeah.
And the splitting of that kingdom, okay, is the splitting up of the unbalanced desire, because that's in the metaphysical world. Scorpio is reaching out for the earth itself. It's reaching for the ecliptic. It wants to come to earth. Its tail is caught in the third part of the stars of the heavens, and it's wrapped around the Milky Way. But it desires to live on earth. It desires life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the essence of the Scorpio. It's also physical desire. And so without Libra, what you have is essentially a very simple metaphor. You have no balance in desire, or you have unbalanced desire.
Mm.
And, of course, therein lies the story of Daniel and the fact that they would divide the kingdom, and they gave the kingdom to the Persians. Okay, and then Darius the Great and the rest of that, you know, there was then the return of the captives and that sort of thing. The important thing on a metaphysical and in terms of the circumcision with regards to Abraham is to recognize that the whole objective of the ancient culture of circumcision was to try to get the young adult male, okay, to recognize that desire, okay, has to be maintained in a sense of balance. And so there is a ritual that goes on. It's part of becoming a man, and the essence of becoming a man is that you learn how to balance your desire, your physical desire, with the needs of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the fundamental judgment day. Now, to think that those 19 guys that flew our airplanes over here and did us in were in a form of balanced desire would be foolish, because they didn't know what they were desiring. They were children of a book. And if I may, Bruce, we could go into your website and look at the picture that shows the judgment scene. But it's about halfway down. It says, "Haughty youth seeking recognition before his time." There's a link.
Oh, yeah, right. I know that. Yeah, when he says website, he's talking about LGC3. Go down to 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, there's a link that says, right here, that when we do the two sets of seven seals, we have the first introduction set so people are familiar. Then the second one breaks it down into the more classical, you can put it, pre-revelatory kind of description of why these seals were placed on the zodiac. So when you go to the fifth seal, which is the door bolt, this is a definition of how we, like as a culture, now forget the individual, a whole culture is going to be admonished for these kind of naivetes and to reach God and understanding just through books, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in a book crazy culture.
Right. Everyone's reading a book. No one's doing anything.
I mean, Amazon.com. I mean, forget it. It's huge. It's like the biggest library in the world we've got. But how much of it is workable?
Right.
So,
Bruce, let me read this real fast so people know what the reference is. Okay, this is on the link that we're talking about is the Haughty Youth one. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
On number 5, the fifth seal, if you go scroll, it's probably about two-thirds of the way down the G3 page. It says the fifth seal at the door bolt is the arrogance of a haughty youth seeking recognition before his time. The sycophant receives the wrath of the true self. The way to inspiration is thereby lost by the self-righteous zealot who attempts to copulate with the teacher of righteousness based upon knowledge in a book. So, yeah, it's exactly what you're talking about, this whole idea that you can get all the answers just by reading what somebody else wrote.
Right, and, you know, this whole process of going through the seven seals or the seven globes or the seven suns all deal with a form of enlightenment, which, which, you know, maybe not for this show, but there are forces out there that would like to keep this from happening, you know. I would like to say that they don't stand a chance, but they're going to do a good job of trying to take down what we believe is such a special world for our future. And these kind of examples of how overabundant consumption, you know, metamaterialistic frenzy has really, you know, seized our planet. I mean, now with China in the picture, it's like really like, oh my God, you can't ask for more prophecy fulfilled, you know, until when you get to the fifth seal. Come on. Fifth seal locks you into what happened at 9/11, and it also locks you into the fact that if everyone suddenly wakes up and sees the amount of junk they've got in their house, you know, they would like to, in the Fahrenheit 9/11 effect, you know, burn it all, because how much of it really is retarding our ability to think clearly.
Right.
So this is the problem. Now, the copulation thing is a symbol that these, I think, brilliant, I mean, I don't know how they did it. These are like the greatest cartoonists, you know, of the time of Babylon, the time of Egypt, that they figured it out that, you know, a student with his little hat on, you know, standing behind the teacher of righteousness.
Let me describe that picture for him, Bruce.
Yeah.
The picture, if you click on that link, it shows a falcon-headed individual right above the O and the K in book. And on top of the head of the falcon is a circle with a serpent. That's a symbol of the sun. Right? In this case, it means cognition.
Mm-hmm.
Above that is what I call a neophyte. He's got a white crown of Egypt, which means a crown of virginity. In other words, he doesn't know what he's doing yet. And he's got a book in hand. And the lioness there, and this, by the way, is the back door of the lion gate, that the character I mentioned with the sun globe on his head, his name is Dorbolt. Okay? The one in front of him shows the red crown of Egypt. The red crown stands for experience. And the name, I don't recall right now what the name of that decon is, the one that's sitting right above the R in the learning.
Mm-hmm.
But it means, it deals with pregnancy. So we're telling us something here that there's a copulation going on here between this neophyte and the lion. And the lion's, or the neophyte's trying to do it by the book, and the lion is basically trying to teach the neophyte how to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, Bruce brought up something really incredible, which I hadn't thought of before. I never used the word. It's a big word for me, the word sycophant, if that's how you say it.
Mm-hmm.
The sycophant character is sitting up on the balance. It shows a child,
yes,
sitting down with his finger pointed at his mouth. In other words, it says me.
Mm.
Okay, in other words, that's the nature of the sycophant, that the universe revolves around their own perceptions. Their consciousness is the consciousness of everything, and they weigh everything based upon what they know. And so the form of righteousness that is being tested is the self-righteousness. If the self-righteousness comes from a neophyte and a sycophant, then what's going to happen is the child is not going to become an heir of Ra, a son of God, if you will. He's going to go with the jackal and start all over again.
Right, I see.
Now, of course, Saturn is to the right of the balance, and, of course, Scorpio is to the left. And you can see there has been a circumcision that occurs right at the foot of Ra, and where we have Scorpio separated from Libra. Now, in front of the lioness is a bull-headed man with a plow in his hand. He's called the bull of my mother. Now, if you understand what's going on at the back end of the lion, then this guy has figured out how to do righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he has figured out how to be a creator of righteousness. and he has come past the day of the last judgment, which is what Saturn implies. Now, beneath the lion, there is another individual that has to do with words, and you can tell that she's sitting up on a little pedestal. It's her bully pulpit, if you will. This also amplifies the idea of her being a teacher of righteousness. Now, the key in to understanding what the, and it's not just the Egyptians, this is very heavily Greek, only they're using Egyptian symbols because Egyptian symbols are far better for carrying a message. The Greeks were into letters.
The
Greeks essentially lost most of the icon imagery. But anyway, the Greeks had fabulous stories, no question about that. But the next picture that you need to jump to is called Becomes the Mat. Okay? In fact, I'm going to skip a screen, but the one down is two paragraphs down, so it becomes the mat.
Right. Again, this is now under the paragraph that talks about the sixth seal, and the paragraph says, to the Egyptians it revealed the status of a man who has cognitive control and becomes the mat at the door into heaven.
Right. And you remember that the doorbolt was the name of a icon. Well, the mat is also a name of an icon.
Okay.
And if you click on that, you'll see underneath the woman teaching the child, which obviously means history, is the one called Matt. And you'll see that there are six stars there, and then the one in front, and it is a sun disk on top of a hawk with the horns of Khnum. The horns of Khnum deal with the Hebrew shofar. Is that the right word, Bruce?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the shofar. Yeah.
Shofar. In other words, it basically is the horn of the ram. It's the horn of rationality. In other words, he's got rational control of cognition. That's what that symbol means.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the back leg of history. History relies on rational cognition and control of rational cognition. The front leg now shows a man. And it's not a hawk. It's a man, or not a falcon, but it's a man. And the man has the Atef crown. And that crown has the horns of Khnum. And then it's got a feathery plume. And it basically has a little globe on the top. It symbolizes, if you will, all-knowing. So this man has control of knowledge. So the guy in the back has control of cognition, and that's the beastly function, because we don't really control cognition. Our senses tell us something. We can recall and determine what the senses are telling us. And that's the whole message of how the one who becomes the bull of my mother, essentially has control of cognition and the control of knowledge.
So the two combined is the trick.
And the two combined support the chair of history.
Yes, there's one leg of each part of the chair. Is on each
behind with a plow.
Right. And the child, by the way, is the same child that was on the balance. So now this child has passed Virgo. In other words, now this child has been born to the Virgin. And the key to be born the Virgin is to realize that we never have a thought that we don't know that we had before. I don't know if I say that right. In other words, we always learn from the state of not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
We always learn from the state of being a virgin. And so when you're born a virgin, it means you're learning.
Mm.
And so this is the process. The child has now opened his mind. He's paying attention to his parents. He's learning history. And above him, you'll see that his head is touching the serpent and the back leg of Leo.
Yes.
Right? And that now is the kingdom of heaven. And directly above the mother and the child, you'll see a crow, which has to do with crone and crony and basically old wisdom. The crow is looking back, telling you it's looking back in the rational direction.
Mm.
And hanging on the tail, it's actually riding on the tail, is a young girl.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it says that our feelings have to go along for the ride.
Uh-huh.
If we let our feelings get in front of us, we get in deep trouble. We actually wreck the lion's gate. But the feelings have to go along for the ride, because if we become totally rational without our feelings, then we're lost.
Right.
Feelings are the key to all communication. We cannot sense without our sensations passing through our feelings. Our feelings filter every sensation. And so the feelings go along for the ride, but they don't make the decision.
Hmm.
The decision made by the young child, the child sitting on the throne. And you'll notice that directly above the maiden, and above the torch in the hand of Virgo, is the planet Uranus. And, of course, that, like I mentioned earlier, that's the father. And Kefra, and John Anthony West, in his book, Serpent in the Sky, was concerned about why cancer was shown there instead of in front of Leo, where it belonged. And the reason why is because they drew Kefra like the image of the dark space above the Milky Way. If you can go to the website, and my website, do a search on Kefra, and you'll eventually come to an image that shows the dark space above the Milky Way. It's shaped like a great beetle, a big dung beetle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the dung beetle is then therefore the one who's at the top of heaven. And this child is looking directly into Kefra. He's the one who raises the sun in the Egyptian mythology. But it's basically, in modern terms, it says if you have a positive mental attitude, you can get to heaven. If you have a negative mental attitude, you can go to hell. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But to give you an idea just how old this stuff is, the link that I jumped over, the one that was one paragraph above that,
yeah,
was Mat of Upper Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
If you click on that, you'll see the stars. You'll see Virgo and Leo. That's Demeter. That's Sirius. That's the entrance to the Lion's Gate is from the right. And you'll see booties. Okay, on a rock.
Yes,
I'm looking at the star pattern. These are actual, connections of the stars. You'll see the potter's field or the flower in Virgo's hand, and you'll see the seven stars of the Great Square. Excuse me, the Great Dipper, Big Dipper. That's the fowl. But on the right-hand side, you will see the first pharaoh of Egypt, Narmer, and he's holding the plow in his hand. He has passed through the Sa, which is the Libra, two stars of Libra, and the child is before him putting down a mat.
Hmm.
And this is the same mat. And before his eyes, on his head he's got the white crown,
yeah,
which the crown of Buddhis, and in front of his face is the scorpion, and beyond the scorpion are the seven-petal stars, which means seventh heaven.
Hmm.
And that goes back to 3100 B.C.,
Wow.
And it's the same expression on the Denver Zodiac we were talking about before.
Amazing.
And
3100 B.C.
I'm sorry?
3100 B.C. Right?
You
said 3100. Right, not 310.
No, 3100
3100 B.C.
Yeah. Wow. So 5,000 some
odd
years.
5,000 years ago.
Right. Egypt was founded in order to build the stairway to heaven. And all the great pyramids were there for that purpose. The great Sphinx at the Giza complex is Demeter, Virgo, Leo, it's Sekhmet, it's that teacher of righteousness that says, if you don't do the right thing, you're going to be behind me.
Mm.
Behind the Sphinx is the graveyard.
Right.
And if you do the right thing, you get to live. If you do the wrong thing, you get to go in a graveyard.
Amazing.
And the thing is, of course, you can do the right thing and end up in a graveyard if you do the right thing for love. In other words, but love, that kind of death will give you eternal life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Greeks, yeah, and all kinds of people have basically acknowledged that. If you have a reason to die, then you've really got a good life.
Right.
You've got a reason to live.
Right.
If you've got something you're willing to die for, that means you really want to live.
It's true.
And if you don't have anything you really will die for, then you really haven't got a purpose for living yet. And so this process of going through the Lion's Gate is that's the essence of what I see and what Bruce is getting across. I lean heavily on the side of the Demeter versus the Zeus side. And Bruce pulls in the rational part of it, and he also has an enormous capacity for knowing when to think.
Huh.
And he has, over the years, has just brought stuff in out of nowhere, from my point of view, and we dig it up and we find all kinds of stuff.
Huh.
Same thing as that last show, and just the discussion we just had about the decans of the Denver Zodiac, that discussion could not have been made when he was there back in June.
Amazing.
We didn't have it then.
Hey, you guys, can I make an observation and have you comment on it? As I look at the image that is the one that we had previously, Rush, the one with Matt and Jet at the bottom,
uh-huh,
and with the mother holding now the young person in her hand, essentially on her lap, with his head touching the serpent above on the lion.
Right.
The mother and child is very reminiscent of images I've seen in cathedrals of the Christ child sitting on the throne of the Mother Mary.
Mm.
Is this any way related, perhaps?
You know, you've got to see what the whole circle looks like. But in front of the child, that would be to the right,
mm-hmm.
you'll see a woman sitting on the throne, and she's got a dream on her head. The dream is kingdom come. What she's holding out are two vials. The vials tell us two things. First of all, they're a balancing point, which means it's an equinox. It's the autumn equinox in Leo.
Oh, boy.
Okay. Opposite that on the dinner zodiac is the same vials in the hands of Aquarius, only he's pouring them out. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So he represents the watering or the spring equinox, and that would be the spring equinox of Aquarius.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And so the time frame of this whole thing happening is the dawn of Aquarius. But what they saw was something that they had seen before they founded Egypt, because the great pyramids of Egypt point to the dawn of Aquarius.
Right.
You can align up those constellations, and you can align up the causeways of the great pyramid, and they will point to Ophiuchus, which is Ra in the Dendro Zodiac.
Mm-hmm.
They will point to Spica, which is Virgo. And they will point to the right hand or smaller star in the belt of Orion, Menkara, I believe it's called. And the three stars of Orion, they represent father, mother, son. And so at that point, the sun of Orion, the sun star, will be as close to east as it will ever be. And it will then be on the east point. So that during that time, the vernal equinox, okay, will rise in the belt of Orion. And Orion will be in its highest position. So Osiris will have fully risen at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the story in the pyramids of Egypt. It's telling that very same story. The Dendro Zodiac is telling the same story. But the stars haven't changed. The only thing that's changed is the people.
Right.
And the people have decided that words are more important than what they see.
Amazing. You know, the equinox is Sunday, Saturday, something like that. 23rd, I think,
21st.
This year.
I think this 21st, 22nd.
I think it's the 23rd this year. Regardless, you know, because of the screwy calendar that we use, you know, you never know where exactly it's going to fall. But at any rate, it's coming up in the next few days.
Right.
Sure.
How significant is that?
It's amazing. I mean, it's the timing is great. If I could add something here.
Please.
When you are focusing on now the, if we go,
hey, Bruce, I'm going to ask you to talk directly into your phone, too.
Oh,
only because,
is that better?
Yeah, it's better. When I have two people on the line at the same time, sometimes I lose a little power on one of them, and yours happens to be that one tonight. So.
Okay. Well, I'll talk a little bit more clear. I want to be sure I'm clear.
You're great there.
Look, when we get to the imagery of the seven seals, there's a part that Rush could complete. In the one of the mat where you have the two jets, you know, they're called jets, J-D-J-E-T's. Right?
Right.
It represents sort of a beginning and an end point. I found that to be very I found that to be very interesting. Yeah, sort of. Rush, help me out there. When we're talking about
it's the one that says becomes the mat. That link, if you go there.
There it is. Yeah, you've got the jet holding the three stars, who is the completed consciousness.
Right, he's right in front of Matt there, yeah.
Right, and then you have, there's a gap, and then you have the jet with three stars again, who is wearing a different crown, who is a hawk person?
He's a hawk with a virgin crown.
Yeah, hawk with
a man with a knowledge crown.
Right, he does, all right. So, this particular creation here, that would be the beginning of yes, of course, at the top when you go to the very beginning and you look at the way in which the City of Nine Lights is presented and how, you know, each globe moves, there is still one part. I don't think where's the part where all the lines are where you have all the lines, you know, the lines that connect the globes. And we have,
it's probably the Center of Nine Lights, that movie.
Oh, yeah, that's where it is. Okay. Well, what they need to know is that when you connect all the globes, to which represents the pathway of the seals, it ends and begins more or less where the first and the last jet is.
Yeah, Bruce, go to that image on underneath the one where Toth is stretched out. And there's a link that says refer to Deacons.
Yeah, refer to Deacons, IJKDZ, link here. And again, for people who are following along online, this is, again, towards the top of the page we've been on all evening, and there is a what's called Plate 61. It's an image of Thoth, and it's a black and white or gray scale image. And just beneath there, again, this is pretty much towards the top of that page, you'll see a link that says refer to Deacons, IJKDZ, link here, and that's what we're talking about. So, all right, so here we are. Okay, so now we've got the whole Dendera there.
Well, now, if you go to what Bruce was saying, on the left side, you'll have G and H.
Yes.
All right. G is the map. H is the end of the jet.
Uh-huh.
And then the one to the right, there's a big gap.
Right.
Underneath the throne of the Virgin.
Uh-huh.
Is a hawk-headed individual with a white crown.
Right. And
that's the beginning of the jet. So what that means is you start counting there. And you'll notice above their heads, I put in numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and it goes around to 37.
Yeah.
All right. That's the cycle. That's, if you will, the path of the 72 virgins. You start there, and the whole cycle of life goes from she wants to be a mother. Okay, remember, this is a temple to motherhood.
Mm.
Okay, so the virgin wants to be a mother. That's where the story begins. Okay? And the story ends with her teaching her child.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
That's what it was all about. That's what Hathor was all about. It was about, you know, motherhood. And it's a story about motherhood. And when you look at the heavens, manhood is read in a rational form, and in that case, you follow the planets. You go in count in a clockwise direction on this picture. And that's what I show the serpent and the Ouroboros, and science in the middle. And the numbers then go 1, 2, 3, and they're numbered with the first day of the year, and they end on the last day of the year. And the last day of the year is, if you will, the day before this helical rising of Sirius.
Amazing.
And at any rate, that's the rational perspective. But the rational perspective does not deal with reality. It deals with what we know. And what we know may be reality, but doesn't have to be.
Mm-hmm.
But what we sense is reality. The key is to get the message of our senses through our feelings without judgment until we can find out what our senses are telling us. And then that's the communication that results in synchronicity.
Hmm. Remarkable.
But what they're saying here, this whole path, okay, if you take this path, and this was unknown until your last show, Mike, or not your last show, but the last one that Bruce was on.
It's amazing.
And we, you know, when you guys started talking about that, I said, well, I better take a run around the outer perimeter, because I had just written them off as Deccans.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, Bruce was talking about the light on the road and the rest of that stuff.
There was that, and also somebody, I sent Rush recently that actual email that somebody had sent to me from the radio show about the, I don't know if they said the connection to, but about Revelations and the Seven Seals. And then from that point on, I mentioned it or sent it to Rush, which we do very intuitively. And then that might have fired up the coal furnace of his. And
well, the whole thing is just blowing my mind. Now,
you're blowing your mind.
My God. What about the Ouroboric reference in the middle there?
That's my drawing.
Okay. So
that's not theirs. But what it basically showing, all rational knowledge is nothing but self-consumption. In other words, you're talking about what you know.
Right.
Well, you're not learning anything.
Uh-huh.
You're just consuming yourself. And, of course, it's this Ouroboros that has to be sacrificed on the balance. The fact that you've got knowledge, and sure, you're right in your self-knowledge, but what do your senses tell you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, have you walked away from your book learning and opened your eyes and looked around and said, this is a fabulous world we live in,
mm-hmm.
and start synchronizing with the world you live in.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start synchronizing the world you live in, then all these things just start happening. And, you know, Bruce has that, I don't know whether it's uncanny, but it's a great capacity to sense something important even though he doesn't know what it is. And he'll come to me and he says, this is important. And I, yeah, why? You know, I got engineering work to do, but I'll, you know, I I may put him off for the moment, but I said, he hasn't come up with anything I shouldn't look at before, so I'll dig into it and I'll find all kinds of stuff.
Interesting.
Well, that's the interesting thing about what we're talking about, because right now the force of the issue of, you know, I want to bring into this thing about how the first horse, the first seal introduces a white horse. And Rush made a great critical discovery when talking online with other people about the Hindu Vedic experience with horse head iconography, right?
Mm.
And it was called Yeshua, which sounds very Hebrew, actually. I'm not really sure if it is Hebrew, but it's, whether it's borrowed from Hindu and Hebrew, I'm not sure, or Sanskrit. But the fact is, it does deal with this notion that the, you know, the Godhead or what have you still reveals itself through a horse image, right? And in the next, are we going to take a break soon, or what are we doing?
Well, it's up to you guys. We've got, we can take one right now. We can wait till the top of the hour.
I was going to say, to build up the excitement here, because I want to, I'm not too sure how much more time we have, but we should conclude at least so that people understand why the four horsemen were so significant.
Mm, okay.
And where that originated and why the power of the horse and more is part of the great excitement of this revelation tonight.
Well, I tell you what, let's leave them hanging there for a few minutes, okay?
Sure.
And we'll come back. We'll talk about the four horsemen and the significance of that iconography, okay?
Great.
All right, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guests are Mr. Rush Allen and Bruce Raphael. We're live with both those gentlemen, one from the East Coast, one from the West. We'll come back with them in just a few minutes. On the web, you can find information about what we're talking about on Kent Stedman's cyberspaceorbit.com. You'll see a link right up at the top of his page that links over to the Lionsgate Cosmology, Part 3. You can also link there directly from my site over at MikeHagan.com. All right? Okay, well, we'll come back with those guys in just a minute. In the meantime, we will hear a piece of music here from my friends Calhoun. Appropriately enough, this one is called Summer Winter. We'll be back in about 5 minutes or so with Bruce and Rush. In the meantime, you can also hear us on the web at kopn.org. And we're streaming live there every Monday and every other hour of the week if we're doing things right, all right? Okay, everybody, back in a minute with Rush and Bruce, and thanks again for listening. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
Love will live on and have renewed. was true, this love would live on, and heaven could renew what we started here today. This world would not subdue.
That's a song called Summer Winter. The band is called Calhoun. You can find information about them on the web at myspace.com/Calhoun. And over there on my music page in the music archives, you'll be able to find a link over there to them as well within the next couple days. And we will also have this program up in the archives as well, hopefully tomorrow afternoon, no later than Wednesday morning, I imagine. And you can download the MP3. Listen to it again, as lots of people like to, and share it with other people, okay? All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We've got Bruce Raphael and Rush Allen with us live on the line. We'll get right back to them, and we'll pose the question about the horse. First of all, the significance of the horse in general, and then the four horsemen, perhaps. If one of you is game.
Oh, okay.
If Bruce isn't going to start, let me finish up that last segment for you, Mike.
Okay.
As you remember, okay, we went through the jet from the beginning to end.
Yes, yes,
and
the whole
cycle. I showed
cycle.
You that it was the virgin dreaming about having a family,
mm-hmm,
and then it was the mother teaching her child.
Yes.
Has it dawned on you yet what the City of Nine Lights are?
Well, I was going to ask. That's one of the things that's on my list here. So,
how long does it take?
Ah,
for this?
9 months, yes.
9 moons.
Mm.
Nine lights.
I
and
see.
That's the city in which Toth rules.
Huh.
It's actually Toth as the baboon that rules. In the last trimester, we actually start to have feelings and we start to learn to communicate with the world outside,
mm-hmm,
even though we haven't gotten out there. But that the City of Nine is that within the womb where we first begin. We first start to develop that thing called a personality.
Wow. Amazing.
Isn't it amazing? And it's viewed in such a mystery at one point that to decode this thing makes it almost like, I could look at this before I go to bed and just crack up. You just got to crack up these, and it's now graphically presented because before, Rush, how big is this ring? It's about the size of it's about 40 feet across or something?
What?
The actual Denver Zodiac.
It's about 8 feet. The circle, 8 foot in diameter.
8 feet in diameter. And again, the actual disc itself is at the Louvre in France?
The actual one they cut out of the ceiling of the temple is at the Louvre. There's another one that's...
So they grabbed one out of one of the temples and then heisted it off there to Paris.
They basically blasted it out with dynamite.
Unfreaking believable. Of course, it's actually perfectly believable. That's what that's the MO of all these guys.
Right. There's another copy in the Rosicrucian temple in San Jose, and then there's one in the one they put back in the ceiling is a copy.
Wow, a copy.
a copy. They repaired the ceiling with a copy.
Oh. Okay.
That's brilliant. But anyway, the fact is, what I'm saying is now the whole world, if you see what I'm saying, why this is an important night, the whole world is handling this, and we haven't even gotten to the ROC yet, but I say the ROC, of Australia. But this alone, I guess if you have to think of a yin and a yang,
the circle and the square obviously has a feeling of the feminine because of the nine, and the stone, you know, the phallic one, is obviously the yang. So we're dealing with a father and mother, you know, out of the first, the word of the father comes out of the first mother. Is that the right? Is that the way you say, Rush?
The first mother will reveal the presence of first father.
Right.
That's supposed to happen in 2012, according to the Maya.
Still, the fact is, what we are dealing with is two strong messages that have transited, we think, now over 30,000 years. One found in Australia, the other one found in Egypt. And we have to take full consciousness and responsibility that, you know, the Ra, I'm going back to, I'm trying to bring this into this picture here, what the, why the horse sort of always represents something important. You know, with all the asterisms combined, we know we have Pegasus, and we know we've got Sagittarius, and we know we have the Centaur, and probably maybe one, well, there's horses that pull things, you know, I think, the chariot, but, or no, or are they goats? No, they're horses, right? The horses pull the chariot, of course, of Ezekiel. But the fact is, in all these cases, the power of the horse still sets us on course to listen to what I think to be the more yang principle. I could be wrong there, because everything else is variable. When you think of horses and the power, and you know, we've got a variety of aspects.
There's a weird relationship between women and horses that I've recognized over time.
Now, yeah, you don't see that so much here, but in the Celtic myths and all, you know, it's a woman or the one in front of Pegasus. I mean the unicorn, and things like that. Obviously that deals with, let's see, what did you say about that, Rush? It deals with, you know, the virgin being taken in by the spiritual aspects of, I don't know, maybe it's the Godhead itself, I'm not sure. You know, unicorn, spiritual, and all that. But the important thing here, I'm leading up to here, is that we're trying to see why the bestiary, I mean, we have lambs, we got beasts, we got creatures, we got lions, you know, it's a real, like, zoo. The first thing to recall in the City of Nine is that the stiff-necked lamb is the form of rationality that seems to interfere or stop or require Isis, you know, you see the kneeling woman behind the stiff-necked lamb. You know, that square picture in the middle of the essay here. You might ask, well, why is she kneeling? You know, why is she kneeling before the lamb? So when the lamb opens up the first seal, obviously we're talking about, you have to have some reason, you know, it's not like a play on words. You have to have a reason to do this, you know. A lot of it is, it's life, right? It's the picture of life itself. But in the Lion's Gate, we are in conflict with our sensibility and our reason. So I believe here, as Rush has indicated many times, that the archer who holds a bow, right, has two options. You hold the bow to your heart, right, or you hold the bow to your eye. If you hold the bow to your eye, you're going to shoot something. But if you hold it from your heart, you're probably searching for wisdom, or you're trying to acquire truth in your strategy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's two aspects. But when there's a battle horse, you know, battle face on the rider himself, you know, he's out to destroy. So, you know, we have to realize that probably the ancients saw the act of destruction as a principle of, you know, yang, maleness, that is something that is combined with desire, you know, and combined with the beast. So our heart really is where all this, you know, the heart, the aspect of the heart is, I think, the ruling discussion here in the lions. You know, the lion has the heart of a lion, you know what I'm saying, you know, heart of a hero. You know, this is the whole aspect now of how we are learning what this path of seven is going to take us. And it leads, for some, I don't understand, but they have four horses that start off this trek, you know. And
expression to cave, that King Tut is a good example of a war, you know, of a leader or an emperor, you know, seeking to wear the not only the blue crown. The blue crown is the battle. That's the battle crown. No, that's the war crown.
War crown.
Right. Right. That war crown is blue, and that's the Corona Australis, but also the Corona Borealis, right? Which is I don't know. How would you describe the Corona Borealis, Rush?
Well, Corona Borealis is a laurel wreath.
Ah, I see. So it,
the Romans wore a laurel wreath. You know, they symbolized that they were crowned in heaven. The laurel wreath represented that, the crown given to Bootes for a successful trip back to heaven.
Right. So I guess the message here on just opening up the first seal is that maybe the power of your own thinking, right, will make your heart be true to what deals with the conquering those that are interfering in your pathway of life, the infidels. You know, infidels don't have to be literally taken. You know, anybody who's taking up your space to get to your truth has to be overcome. So maybe the first seal in recognizing, you know, the path of life is that there is some sort of intent that you have before you're born, right? Because we're dealing with 9 months, you know, nine, city of nine. So when you start, it's like almost before you're born. So it's possible that this intent is inherited somehow in this, you know, magical script of life.
Right.
And, you know, we all have to carry it somehow in various degrees. So it's possible that, you know, when we're looking at the lamb, you know, with the little picture of the stiff-necked lamb that has a zero over it, this is another interesting thing about lordship and kingship, which we'll get into later. Rush indicated in the early onset is that, unusual as it is, you know, our egos interfere a lot of the time with our ability to know our place in the universe, right? So, you know, there's a lot of, like it is with great literature, you know, there's a lot of archetypal discussion here that's trying to teach you something, you know. So we'll get into that later, but let's...
Well, Bruce, let me add something here while you're still at the stiff-necked ram.
Yeah.
The easiest a correlation in the biblical story is the story of Moses and the well at Jethro, and where the seven sisters, you know, were basically put down by the shepherds. And that's what that statement says. It says the seven sisters, which are the seven stars, the Pleiades, the sweetness of the Pleiades was basically put down by the stiff-necked ram, in the sense that we could not deal with just feelings. We had to come up with a rational description of what we were doing. This is the door, the sheep door. This is the place where we start to go about our father's business, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's right. That's good. Yes, right. This is like you have to coalesce all this, these issues into the doorway, as you enter.
The four horses, by the way, Bruce, are seen right in front of the stiff-necked ram. You'll notice that there are four serpents. They're actually four little human beings with tails. They're not fully born yet, so they're basically, you know, zygotes.
Uh-huh,
and in front of the zygotes sits Horus in the form of Hippocrates on the flower. So he's heaven's child. He's got a flail in hand, means he's got mastery of his physical, and he's still pointing his finger at his own self. In other words, he's saying, feed me, tell me, serve me, do for me. And the horses have yet to been grown up, if you will. He's still, the four horses won't come to him until he gets over his Sagittarius.
Which image are we looking at right now, you guys?
I'm looking at that one that had the complete wheel of the decans.
Okay, all right.
I keep forgetting.
No, it's all right. It's all right. Again, everyone, this is the full disc of the Dendera Zodiac, and the one that has that Bruce has numbered and lettered with the number thing. So
now, this is interesting. I never even imagined that, but yeah, that makes sense. We're at the Lamb's Gate or the door. And we've got the four elements, right? The four elements of sorts. You said earth, air, fire, water.
Right.
Which are the four horses. Oh, that's like a play on words, isn't it? Wait a minute. Horus.
Mm-hmm.
The four, you said, Rush, these are like the four Horuses, right?
Well, it's the same thing. It's Horus and his four sons. But they aren't developed yet. They're still in the zygote form.
Right, but horses sound, you know, say fast, so it sounds like horses.
Yeah, there's a connection there. Also, right, you know, if you look at that image, the one of the full circle dendro where it has science and the Ouroboros in it,
mm-hmm.
Yep.
if you can roll your eye 90 degrees in the middle, you'll see Tarret. And as you were speaking before, I got to realize that Tarret is a hippopotamus.
Uh-huh.
And a hippopotamus is a river horse.
Oh, my God. A river horse.
And in case you haven't picked up on this, Mike, this stuff is still unraveling as we speak.
Right,
oh,
I love it. I love
God,
it.
A river horse. That's beautiful. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, you wonder where all these names come from, you know, and it's like, oh, well, now we know why they call it a river horse.
Yeah. Anyway, the four horses, you begin the journey toward the four horses at the gate, the ram's gate, and then you carry on. You know, from there, you've got to transform the intuitive aspect of the mother who's been put down, and you've got to, you know, go around till you get to the point where you have rational wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, near the end.
That would be all the way around when you get back to Sagittarius. You know, you will have crossed the whole... This is, if you will, the Ark of the Covenant. This is the path from Taurus, okay, through to Sagittarius. And that will get you back up on top of the Milky Way.
Back on top would mean like above the Duat or just...
Well, above the underside of the Milky Way. Back up above where heaven is, heaven above.
Right.
You know, and the proof that this is the Ark of the Covenant is if you go to, on that figure, number 18 or number Z... You see a child. There's a child with a patah head. Basically, it's a pre-yarmulke. And you'll see that he's holding laws in his hand.
That's right. I see.
And he's got the laws of the heavens.
The four heads.
Hey, Bruce.
The four heads of the ram, number one. And then you'll see this kid walking with this, looks like a tablet. Has five stars below, which I don't understand that one.
I would say those five stars are symbolic of Horus and his four sons.
Hmm.
Uh-huh, Horus.
But there's another thing that's happening here that's hidden, and that is that if you go back to where the lady was kneeling, there are 14 stars above the boar or the pig.
Yeah.
The boar was a symbol of intuition.
Right.
The 14 stars represented Osiris and Isis, or the 14 parts of Osiris. The seven were taken away because they were the female side of Osiris.
Uh-huh.
And they were going to develop, in other words, Khnum, the stiff-necked ram, is going to make a man out of it. Was he's going to teach him to be rational. And so in the middle of this arc, you'll find the laws. The lawgiver, right above the laws, you'll see a star, and you'll see a circle with some tails underneath it.
Yeah, it looks like a comet. Or whatever.
It looks like a comet. It's a symbol for a comet. But what it really is, it's a symbol that means light. So it means starlight. Or, if you will, it means star knowledge or star wisdom.
Ooh.
And that's what's written on the stones. Cool. In other words, it's the code of heaven.
Bruce Rush, let me do a quick ID here because we're right around the top of the hour. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. All right, so right back to it.
So, yeah, back into it. We're still sort of understanding how the first seal reviews the split of the 14 stars, the sweet influence of the Pleiades are bound. Now, the bands of Orion are released. The bands of Orion, is that like the belt?
That would be the belt, right.
But when you say are released, as in to take off his belt?
Well, in the book of Job, it says that when God speaks to Job after Job had been made a mess of himself for 40 chapters, God says, who are you to, can you release the bands of Orion, or can you bind up the sweet influences of the Pleiades?
The Pleiades, yeah.
In other words, the point is that, Job, doesn't matter what you know, you didn't cause it. You're not the cause of everything.
Hmm.
And so they release the bands of Orion. Orion is a symbol of responsibility. He holds up the ecliptic and the Milky Way.
Yeah, right. Like he's like... You know,
burden
like
is to earth. Carry the whole world on his shoulders. He's essentially Atlas under the world.
Oh, yeah.
Rush, is the counter implication, though, that when Job, or if Job, or anyone for that matter, were to make the shift that we've been talking about, that then they would be able to loose the bands of Orion and...
Well, the point is that the way you release the bands of Orion is by denying the stars. And the way you bind the sweet influence of the Pleiades is by not looking at them.
Hmm.
In other words, when you lose your capacity to sense and then become cognizant of what you sense, then you have lost it all.
I see.
And that was the admonition to Job. Job, you know, that's wonderful. You get all this good book learning, but you can't see what your eyes are telling you.
Mm.
And if you go look out there and you look at the Pleiades, anybody's ever looked at the Pleiades, you know, they've got the marvel. They are a sweet-looking set of stars.
Yes.
And then if you go to Orion, you see Orion in a majestic, massive constellation with the belt, you know, cinching his, girding him, if you will. And he represents the symbol for the responsible man, and yet he's also a symbol of a man on an ego trip.
Mm.
Right.
And, of course, that's the nature of Job. Job, you know, had all his book learning, but he couldn't, you know, comprehend what his books were telling
him.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Anyway, I don't want to stop the four horsemen situation because that's kind of crucial to the line.
Yeah, we're getting there. So remember, we've got, it's complicated, you know, if you go back to to take meaning as literal and then to draw down and see how it's, fathomed, this is part of this, our task, you know. And it took, you know, great sort of a, I thought I was daft, I mean, like going nuts at this time trying to stitch together all this, but it sort of fell into place. Once it sort of fell into place, I can't explain it any other way, but it fell into place. That's why when you come to the second horse, you know, you are still aware that, you know, there's more to come. I mean, in the sense that you're still invited to carry on, but you have to deal with this great red dragon of desire, which is sort of something that you're said to have to leave behind, you know, when you enter into this temple, the temple of the mother, to reach this virginal capacity to be part of the stars or be part of the
life.
Cosmic intent, right? You can't get there unless you're going to have to confront some really bad stuff. So, you know, we're now in the second horse, we're dealing with, you know, this great sword of desire, and it's pretty clear that basically, you know, you have to be able to pass through this horse, you know, or pass through this not Mars, not reasonable kind of aspect of the path. I'm not too sure why it's second in line, you know, or why not third or fourth, but once you understand the passage of the four, why it's in this order, it has another sort of code that it reveals, which, I've been playing with myself, and Rush answered his idea. So, if you move on to the third seal, it's sort of interesting, the black association with Libra. You know, remember, black, you know, the maiden there is covered, her eyes are covered. So she can't see. So there's sort of a sense of darkness. You know, not being in the cloud of the Milky Way, yes, maybe, but still the woman of Libra is got the burqa over her face. So that's something to consider, you know, this whole issue. But the horse aspect itself, that's a little tricky here because, you know, what are we looking at? Are there horses here or not? So, you know, I wanted to have Rush sort of come up with a little bit of a defense because when you look at the wheel and the number three or the third, what's considered to be the third, what you are looking at, though, outside of Libra, is the Sagittarian, you know, the rider, the archer on the back of a horse, moving from three to four. So, you know, it's a difficult to sort of wrap it up in a simple statement. You say, well, where are the scales? Well, you know, yes, the scales are not near there necessarily. You know, you could look or see where Sag is, but the scales are actually sort of above and over its head. You know,
the position of Sagittarius is that of a Pharisee. Right? He's got his book learning, he's got his knowledge, and he's going to tell the cosmos what's going on. This is Job telling the cosmos what's happening.
Right.
But what happens is, if you look at the actual asterisms of Sagittarius, you'll see that the bow is pointed at Sagittarius's mouth.
Right.
In other words, the cosmos is giving him words to say.
Huh.
And the nature of all wisdom is that when we learn to listen, we learn to talk.
Uh-huh.
Okay. If we can talk without listening, what do we say?
Right.
How many of us have run into guys who talk without listening? You know, you don't know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strange, actually. It's a really weird phenomenon when you run into someone like that who actually does not listen to a word you say.
Yeah, and you got to be very careful. I mean, this stuff is dangerous stuff because we, you know, we continually get involved, Bruce and I, and we get carried away, you know, talking, and you know, we lose everybody along the way.
Well, I mean, it is sort of daunting for, you know, for everyone, but that's just the nature of it, I think, and that's why we just keep going at it, you know, and stuff gets parsed out in the middle of the whole thing, and I think that people hear what they need to hear. There's something like that. There is something very strange going on where, you know, the people that are listening, the people that stick around, the people that get a hold of this, they somehow seem to be the right people.
Right, but what Bruce is saying about the four horsemen, to understand it, you have to realize that this four horsemen imagery has to do with the centaur idea and with the horse and with the seahorse and with the seahorse being the constellation Cetus, which also is drawn with a horse's head,
mm-hmm.
and with the constellation Quetzalcoatl in Egypt and Greece and India was seen as a horse's head. And so what they're saying is that the words are coming from the heavens, and you got to be able to see them. To see the words, you've got to see the stars and then read the placement of the stars to understand that, you know, even if there wasn't meaning in the stars, we have 30,000 years in our genes
right.
of people who've read those stars.
Right.
And there's a huge library up there that will reveal to ourselves much about ourselves that we otherwise wouldn't know. But it's there. I mean, if you don't know anything about Carl Jung and his idea of synchronicity and the idea of the collective unconscious.
Yeah.
The collective unconscious in Egypt was Osiris. And everything we've known throughout history that has been passed on, as you will, is in the body of Osiris. And so we are born in that city of nine. We go through that process and we learn. And what we're learning is the process, first of all, a genetic, physical process. And then as the mind starts developing the rational capacity and the ability to convert senses to feelings and then to thoughts, we're starting to develop the relationship. But a lot of that relationship skills is stuff that we learned 20,000 years ago. It shows up. And that was one thing that marveled Carl Jung. He says, this stuff has been around for ages.
Hey, Rush, we got time for sort of a left-field question. I love Carl Jung. He's one of my, I think he's the, if you're going to read psychology, he's the guy, you know. But he wrote this interesting book in 1952 or 53 called Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky. And I don't know if you've ever come across it, but it's a remarkable book because he had a lot of interest in the whole flying saucer business, believe it or not. And I didn't know if you, either one of you, want to take a stab at that, but does the flying saucer or the UFO play any role in this whole business that we're approaching?
Well, I could just comment here that the Denver Zodiac itself is Ezekiel's wheels within wheels. So people have discussed it on many different terms of Merkaba, you know, the more esoteric stuff. Still, here within this very story of the nine, we are dealing with the image of the wheels within the wheels. So macrocosmic, microcosmic, you know, it's the vision of how the cosmos enters into our consciousness, and sometimes we digest it and sometimes we don't. So it's possible from that basic level, maybe students of the cosmos, when they were studying this stuff, would start maybe with the temple, perhaps, before they started having visions of actual ships, you know. So it's possible that what we're talking about is pretty much a phenomena of our imagination, you know.
Mm.
Yes, I'm not saying that these things didn't exist because Carl Jung interviewed people.
Right, and he was one of the, that's one of the reasons why I was so interested in Jung's perspective on the UFO was that he was comfortable with the fact that it was a denizen of the imagination, but he also believed that via the phenomenon of synchronicity that the thing could actually have efficacious, you know, effect here in three-dimensional reality. It could actually be real.
Well, that's exactly what you have to separate when you're looking at Jung. With Freud, you know, he had problems, but obviously he got started. He did break the code with regards to the Trinity, and his superego, ego, and id, and that's the last three sons, if you will, in Denver's zodiac are the superego, ego, and id. But what Jung recognized was that there's material inside our unconscious, this collective unconscious cause, that material is everywhere, and a person does not have to experience it in their life to have it. And a lot of it is essentially a genetic experience. A lot of it comes from what's happening while your brain is forming in utero. But there are certain symbols that tell you precisely what they mean. For instance, when you see a circle as opposed to a square, a circle is an irrational thing. And so you see the metaphor of a circle all over the place. Circles and spirals are irrational things. In other words, they're not right or wrong, they're just not rational, whereas a square is perfectly rational. And so the Denver Zodiac, for instance, is surrounded by a square where the four maidens stand with their feet in the corners of the world. The implication is that the father is rational. But in the side, the father is the mother, the yin. Okay, and she's not rational. She is sensitive, emotional, physical, however else you want to describe it. But what you can't do is you cannot describe the essence of a woman without using the word love.
Isn't that the truth?
And the bottom line is what the Denver Zodiac, when you go around this trip, when you go around this whole journey, when you get and you go through Uranus, or Uranus, what you do is that path takes you right through the sheep door and right to Venus. And Venus means, that you put the two together, Aries means I am, and Venus means love. And so the story says, I am love. And of course, that's inside the circle. And that's what they were trying to get across. And of course, the emotional aspect and the love aspect, that was all shot down in Mesopotamia. You know, they said the world had to be totally rational.
Mm-hmm.
And they killed Tiamat 5,000, 10,000 years ago. Tiamat was, if you will, the sacred first mother.
Yeah, the Mother Earth. And, you know, it's an interesting correlation between words again. I think of the word mat, M-A-T, that we were talking about earlier. And, of course, that's the root of the word mother in Latin, mater, M-A-T-E-R, and, of course, matter as in material. But then I also think of Tiamat, and Tiamat, of course, still has that M-A-T root in there. Anyway, just an observation.
Well, no, but the observation is key. You know, you probably don't have time to do it, nor does anybody else. It's only like crazy guys like Bruce and I have the time to do it. We go out there and we think this over and over again, and it comes up, and you know, a week later, hey, gosh, it finally came to me. I know what it was now. You know, it's like I've seen Tarot for years and years. It never occurred to me that she looks like a horse. But, you know, obviously the horse thing is part of the deal. But the square and the circle are not just ideas and concepts. They are actually drawn in the sky. And I mentioned to you we were going to come to the end of the program. We were going to come to the ladder, to Jacob's ladder.
Right.
Yep.
In Jacob's ladder, and this is where Bruce and I first got started, there is a circle. It's the circlet of Pisces. And a circlet of Pisces underneath the great square. And both of them are in the temple of what's called the Temple of Solomon. And the circle and the square are the fundamental requirements to have, to get the key to get through the kingdom, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
If you cannot use your intuition and your feelings, it doesn't matter what you rationalize. You're just blowing smoke. But if you can convert your feelings, the irrational feelings, into sensations, which are not rational, and bring them back into a rational state, you come up with the most, in fact, the only rational emotion. And that rational emotion is what, on the Denver Zodiac, is called love.
Mm-hmm.
They say love, and Aries is the rational house of the rationality, the house of the sheep, the I am. That means I am rational. But it's got Venus in that house, which means
house
I am
love, yeah.
Rational love.
Mm.
And of course, that's, if you will, father love.
Right. Now, that's very good. That's what we're leading into. The fourth seal, we can remark that love works in both directions. There's the mother love and father love. And when the father and son are one, there is a, I guess you could say, a mathematical thing in the circle where a line is drawn from the consensual instincts of the baboon, you know, Toth himself, and he stretches the line through the shaft or the rod of control of Ophiuchus, could see it in the circle there. And then the line keeps going and passes through the second rod of the sun, which is, I think, Osiris. Isn't that Osiris?
Yeah, you're looking at the picture on the webpage, right? The Dendro Zodiac picture on the webpage?
Yeah, hold on. Yes, that people must understand because we're leading to a very important aspect. Like when you think of love, sex, desire, okay, great. What about the father and son love? Well, when the Bible refers to the father and son are one, it's a very unusual thing that 48 B.C. they were talking about it. The Ophiuchus, who represents, I guess, the boat of Ra, is that correct?
Ophiuchus represents, that's Ra in position.
Yeah, well, he's holding a shaft, and it passes through, you know, in the green part, it passes through desire, and in the control rod of Ophiuchus, through the, almost through the navel of the seahorse, past the leg of the first Paschal lamb. Is that Taurus? I'm not sure about that. I forgot about that one. But it's another important part of the Trinity.
I want to make sure that we're all looking at the same image. Bruce, are you looking at the LG?
The central square of the circle of the zodiac, which is in the center part of the story.
It's about halfway down the LG3 file.
Right. And you've got the seven lights, seven mm-hmm. lamps, you know, that we have so far. But there's some unusual white line that passes.
Yes.
Almost dividing it in half, actually, almost perfectly.
Yeah, not quite. A little off-center, but yeah.
The line represents the combined path of Ra, who is the Father in heaven, and the Evangelist, which is Orion on the lower right. They both carry staffs, and their staffs are perfectly aligned, and they go through, going up, they go through the Scorpio, and they go into the pillar, if you will. And on top of that pillar, there sits a disc, a moon disc, on the head of a beast.
Yeah.
And it's hard to recognize what this beast is, but it represents an altar of instincts.
The altar of instincts.
We walk in the instincts of our fathers until we recognize what we're doing.
So it's interesting that they decided to draw this line through the two staffs of the sun walking with the little rooster behind him. Is that a rooster?
Well, you're talking about Osiris? Are you talking about Orion?
Yeah, Osiris.
That actually is the phoenix, okay?
Phoenix.
Put it there looking like a cock, so what we have there is Orion looks like a cocky man.
Huh.
You know, he's running off. He's all inspired by the intuition, or not the intuition. He's all inspired by the internal knowledge of his fathers.
Right.
And he can do anything. And of course, anybody who's got any young kids, young boys, anyhow, understands this.
I got a 4-year-old boy and a 1-year-old boy.
You know, wait till they're 12 or 16.
My God, I can't even imagine. My 4-year-old is outrageous already, and I marvel and cringe at the same time.
But. This is fascinating. The math and the metaphor. You know, that line passes through the circle of the young lad inside that circle. You know, the brownish circle on the scales, which you said was, let's see, how did you phrase it? It's sort of the self-consuming youth.
Yeah, that would be your sycophant.
Yeah, the neophyte sycophant. Yeah,
right.
I think that's
right,
how you
that's
say
the sycophant. But it's all sort of touching. You know, it's perpendicular.
Tangent, whatever.
Right.
But you know, the thing is, you got to realize, Mike, is when you look at this line that Bruce is talking about between the staff of Orion from the lower right, it goes diagonally across the picture, and it lines the two staffs, one of the Father Ra, and the one of the son Orion.
Right.
Okay? And it goes through the altar of instincts.
Uh huh.
Okay. Now, about halfway, just beyond the rump of the bull.
Yes.
You'll see there is a little character there holding something in his hand.
Yeah.
What he's holding is a head of a lamb on a little stick.
Head of a lamp?
Head of a lamb.
Oh, a lamb.
Right. And it's basically
it's like
the light of a
lamb.
Home. In other words, what this guy is doing, this is the constellation of Riga. He is telling the twins to go this way. Don't go with the bull. Go towards the lamb.
Huh. Oh,
go through the sheep door. In other words, go between the sacrificial lamb, which is at his head, and that basically what you have up there.
That's right. The Paschal sacrificial lamb, which is at his head, yes.
It's also a quarter of beef with a lamb sitting on it. Okay? Huh. And what it means is the lamb means I am, and the quarter beef means carne. So it means I am, and it's a returning trip, so I am recarnate.
Oh, my goodness.
And so you're going to recarnate the lamb, and that's why Amun is saying, go to the door of the sheep, and then you will be reincarnated. In other words,
and
you've got to know yourself.
Who's that little character again who's on the hand side of the Gemini twin?
Yeah, on the male side of the Gemini twin, the yellow one. That is the constellation Riga. Okay, it's star Capella, and it's the shepherd's light. And it is also the light of Amun, which means it's the shepherd's light. And he's showing the way to go between the bull, okay,
yeah,
and
two bulls, right. There's the Paschal one, and then the ascent of the other.
Right. So he's taking you through that little path, trying to get you over to the sheep door.
Now,
in other words,
sheep door,
don't be just physical. Be rational.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, what's really mind-boggling, Mike, and this is something that probably can't be communicated on a radio or anywhere else, is that there's a picture on the very top of Bruce's page.
Mm-hmm.
He had...
this is fascinating.
It shows the...
is this that star photo?
It's a star...
That's being, fed off of another star or something.
White dwarf that's basically pulsating because it keeps consuming a red giant.
Mm, right.
Okay. And what's amazing, if you follow the link that's up there, it's an interesting trip, but, you know, you have to go through the link and look at the picture. It requires the pictures. You can't really talk about it.
Right.
But it says, enter the city of nine, the humble
walk
of Talk City.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it goes through there, and...
Wow, there's the big image of that, right? Dead star erupts, okay.
But what happens is that path, okay, the path to that star, R.S. Ophiuchi,
mm-hmm.
If you look at that path, it is exactly the same path as between these two staffs, between Ra and Orion, or Ophiuchus and Orion on the Dinner Zodiac.
Is that right?
That's one of those synchronicities that Jung talks about.
Holy cow.
Now, the way that happened,
yeah.
The way that happened was one of our listeners who have been following all the stories and have been, you know, carefully trying to understand Rush's, wording and everything, channeled this. She came across this message, and at the same time Rush was working on it, which we didn't know this, she funneled this information in for him, and that's how this happened.
That's amazing.
So go figure that out. Now, you have to understand this event that takes place in space in the constellation Ophiuchus is significant for more than that, because I guess if you scroll down, keep going, scrolling down, there's a picture of the knee. Light on the Road to Damascus. Okay.
Yeah, but go above that. Three little squares where it says Chariot of Gods.
Oh, yeah, Chariot of the Gods. Okay, we'll start there. I mean,
if you click on Chariot of the Gods, what you're looking at is you're out beyond the galaxy looking back, okay, across the whole solar system. So Orion is down below, and then, you know, you see the light of Amun, if you will, the shepherd, okay?
Yep.
And the shepherd's up above Orion. So you're looking at the sky, and that's the reverse of what we'd see if we went out and looked. It's flipped over backwards, left to right.
Oh, yeah, there's the shepherd overlooking Orion, right?
Yeah, he's above Orion, above the sun. Okay.
Yep.
Now, if you go to the next picture, okay?
Which is he brought them home?
He brought them home. You'll see that if you take the child, the shepherd, and project him to the other side of the sky, he's right on the arm. The arm of Ophiuchus is wrapped right around him.
Oh, you mean, how did you do that? By
folding? Well, go to the bottom picture now, Road to Damascus.
Yeah.
Okay? Oh, but that's a movie. You've got to be careful with that one. It'll step through. But Road to Damascus shows the views when you look from outside the galaxy back to the cosmic center, the cosmic womb or the Maya location for the winter solstice, that sort of thing. And you look through that picture, you'll see Orion, you'll see the shepherd, and then when you see the other side of the sky projected simultaneously, you'll see that the shepherd is under the arm of the Father.
Huh. You mean as if you looked at it from both angles?
You got to go off the galaxy and look back, and you see them all. You're looking through the solar system. I mean, it's a point of view that you can only get by realizing that, you know, you could put yourself beyond the stars and look through, and this is what you would see if you saw that projection.
Amazing.
And of course, when you do that kind of stuff, it should be fairly clear that this is not heavy stuff. This is very light stuff, but it's got a huge amount of detail.
Mm.
And you've got to connect all the dots in the sky before you see this stuff. But that constellation, if you look carefully, and just go back to the Chariot of the Gods for a moment,
yep,
and you'll notice that there is a man, okay, with a female goat and three kids. Right? This is the picture of the Good Shepherd. This is the monument of the Good Shepherd in Christianity.
It is
scary when you see some of the stuff at first. But bottom line is, it's saying that they said it was the Word of God. It said that God put the stars there because he wanted to say something. And the message that it says, you know, and he brought them home, you'll see in the picture where he says he brought them home, you'll see that the Good Shepherd has the arm of the Father wrapped around him.
Hmm.
Oh, right. There's the Father love.
And of course, what else could you ask for?
Right.
And there is R.S. Ofuki. And that's what blew me away.
Right.
The only reason I looked at that plane and that angle was because of this, you know, this star that was being fed by another star.
And it does look like an arm that's wrapped around it.
Yeah, and it's got an arm wrapped around the child who is the Good Shepherd.
Right.
Now, with this star, this is not like the repeater that was in Cetus of a 300-year thing. Does this thing occur? What is the...
I don't know what the cycle is of R.S. Ofuki, but it's been around for quite a while.
That's my point, that you go back far enough, they would have recognized this.
I doubt if they'd ever seen it. It's not that bright. It's not bright enough they'd see it. Now, they would have seen Mira, the one that has the cycle of 300.
Well, they saw Mira. How
did
they know this one was there? Or they didn't. They just saw a bright light?
They wouldn't have seen this at all.
Hey, Bruce. Both of you, actually. I just want to put a little time marker here. We got about 20 minutes or so, and I want to make sure that we talk about the rock, the Australian connection, and I'm not sure what else, but I'm just getting a little bit concerned about time. So
we get through that, I think everybody would have had a pretty good tour of this. I mean, we've set them up enough so that, you know, okay, we didn't have to read through each and every seal, but as you read through it, you can always hopefully... comment, or eventually we'll probably have this assembled into a book. But in the meanwhile, let's proceed. You know,
yeah,
we should proceed.
The quick summary on the rock, Mike, is this: the rock is a symbol set up where they could perform their ritual worship, but they couldn't build a temple. They were basically in a transient condition.
Where did the rock come from? Is this something that Bruce discovered?
Let me give you a quick story. In the 1980s...
How big is it?
we've demonstrated that in another article.
All right, anyway.
The description I have of it, I think, in the last one.
Okay, I'm sorry, go on.
But that's okay. It's about 3 feet high, weighs 90 pounds, it's basalt crystal, and it's, for now, providing what we think is good evidence that, you know, it's an Australian volcanic basalt, not taken from some other part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it was made with careful engraved abilities so that the story that was told was one as old as the one that we're dealing with the Denver Zodiac. And it deals with imagery that supports not necessarily the way in which McHugh, you know, transcribes it because of the parts, you know, the careful proto-Sinaitic script that probably the artisans back then could weave into an image. You know, you see it from a distance,
mm-hmm,
but look
mm-hmm
carefully, it's filled with letters. It's a living thing. It's talking. It's a talking rock.
Uh-huh.
Right? The Aborigines had a story about this, right? And they knew that when Baham came, he brought his son Tudun, and Tudun was the master craftsman who made this rock. And when you put it on its face, it waddles like a porcupine, right? So they said, I mean, the way I figured that out was when I was reading these Aboriginal myths, they said that it also was able to waddle off as an echidna, which is a porcupine. And so I put it on his face, and it literally rocked like an echidna walks. And I said, this has got to be the stone that these Aboriginals saw. So we know that we're looking at a time where this kind of iconography, which was looked at by Professor Bianchi from the Museum of Natural History back in the 80s in New York when we brought the rock, he was blown away. He'd never seen anything like this in his life.
So where you actually have it in your possession?
No, it's now safely back in Australia. Okay, and it went on tour. I mean, there's enough of a story in my book how the rock, you know, went all over the place. Went to Hawaii twice, went to America. I was a custodian for it for a while, then I gave it to a friend when I went to Australia. And then a special person from Australia came and picked it up, brought it to Washington, D.C., and then he ended up bringing it to Colorado to meet up with a pyramid lady who was Marilyn, the woman who, if you remember, if you read through all the stories, that she was involved in bringing me to the Tree of Life when I originally went to Australia for the first time, because she was in search of the tomb of Adam and Eve. Okay? So, it's pretty intense. We are dealing with a true Tree of Life, both in the heavens and sort of rooted somewhere in some physical form. But the rock came to her in the early 80s, right? She had it, purchased it as an artifact, and then brought it to America. And if you read through my last one on Mira and the prophecy of the Hopi, I tie this into that, you know, they had a prophecy that this rock would finally come to America and speak, right?
Uh-huh.
It did.
Yeah.
And you'll have to read through that again. It'll refresh your thoughts on it. But basically, in 1983, in October, there was a big peace conference, and the rock came almost identical at the same time when Marilyn was coming to America to meet me and so forth and so on. That rock was viewed by many Native American Indians and Tibetan priests, and it was a whole big fanfare that took place over a few days in New York City.
Oh, all right.
So the rock was on tour. It was a rock on tour. That was the name of it.
Rock and roll.
The rock on tour. So that rock ended up into more or less my midst, of course, because I got to know Marilyn. And it just became a fascinating story because we worked so hard to decode it, you know, because circles and, you know, 23 lines and the face. But in due time, it got more complicated. We started to see that. We gave it to another person, Charles Boyle, and he transcribed some stuff he saw on it, which is very similar to what McHugh said, but also different, you know? Also from a different perspective of the way words are translated from etching. So, but it was all pretty close. That rock was carrying a very important story, and as Rush would say, I think, based on what it looks like, you know, the snakes are like a mouth, the sun. Now, this is like First Father talking. This deals with the Word of God in the most primitive, or I should say, early aboriginal, you know?
Yes.
First Father.
Uh-huh.
Look, it's pretty clear, you know, when this stone was carved and put together, it was to at least be almost like a tabernacle of tabernacle of the sun to bring this truth in the most perfect way, I guess.
Rush, and how does it tie in now with what we've been talking about previously, and how does it tie in with the Dendera, et cetera?
Yeah, that's Rush's specialty. How do we dovetail the two?
Well, it has to do with the ancient, you know, love of creation, love of the Creator. I mean, they couldn't carry a temple around with them, you know, and it appears that they didn't have books at the time. So they carved this stone. They probably set the stone up, and they, you know, they went out there and they performed their, you know, celebration ceremonies, their life ceremonies, you know, with this stone to give them that extra spiritual strength. I mean, if you've ever been in a forest where they have a chapel set up in a forest, you know, they put up a cross or they put up something, and then people sit around and they sing songs and they do their thing.
So the object of focus, essentially. Yeah.
Right. It adds additional spiritual strength.
Right. Okay. All right. So, onward. Yeah. Let's continue.
Well, let me try to summarize the rock in this way. If we go back to the webpage, the LG3 webpage, and that version of the Dendera that Bruce was discussing, we had before.
Yeah, the one right in the middle there?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
We'll take the way of the 72 virgins. Right? You'll notice that it starts, you know, right after the words, way of the 72 virgins.
Right, that's
Jet. It's aligned with the bow, the arrow, actually, in the maiden's hand.
Uh-huh.
And the arrow is pointed high, okay?
Yes.
In other words, you've got to be motivated. You've got to aim higher
high.
Than the earth.
Yeah.
The earth is
yeah,
like
yeah.
the cow.
All right.
It then goes to the ram's head.
Which has a sun.
It says number zero.
Right.
Okay. Then it was what she's saying is to the man, and it goes right through his head. He's inspired by her beauty, and he's running off to do her bidding for her. And this is the nature of youth. Okay. And she is saying with her bow, do the right thing. Okay.
Mm.
And of course, that's what the stiff neck ram represents. Then you go from the stiff neck ram over to the four rams, which means you've now rationalized the four elements. And then you take it through the laws and you go to the great shepherd, in which the great shepherd is satisfied with putting people in bondage. In other words, he's a leader.
Mm.
And then you go from there, you go to the sun disk on a man, and it passes through the head of Thoth and over a little lamb, which is the humble shepherd.
Yeah.
And then through the disc of the man, that's the light on the road, if you will.
Right.
That's the plate where enlightenment comes. Then you go through Sagittarius, which is a sign of wisdom. You then move to the tower or the altar with the altar of instincts, if you will.
Yep.
And then you move to the door bolt, okay, where you are now given the opportunity to copulate with the teacher of righteousness. If you can do it, then you can create righteousness, which means you are going to become a divine person in your own right. And then you move from there to where the book under her forelegs are, which means you now have your own bully pulpit. Then you go to number seven, and what's called number seven there. That happens to be the one who is in control of cognition.
Mm.
You then take a hard, what would be a left turn on this path, and you go through the staff of Uranus, which is up above little girl
above from the
cancer
shield,
there.
The woman on the end of the line.
Yeah, and you go straight across through the eye of Aries, okay, and through the ram on the reincarnation symbol, through the eye of Aries, and then through the female aspects of the beast that is the two signs of
Venus. Right?
Venus. That's the symbol for Venus. And what that means is you just went through on this journey, in the way of the virgins, you went and you got the golden fleece, which is to say, I am love.
Huh.
And then it ends on the head or the forehead of the child on the lotus. In other words, the journey of life doesn't end with us. The journey of life goes on with those who we pass on the message to. And the message that we want to pass on is the same message on the rock as the same message in the zodiac. The message to pass on is to love the generation to come.
Mm-hmm.
And what culture doesn't believe that?
Right.
Yep. Love the generations to come. That's very good. You know, if I could add here before we conclude the show.
Please.
You know, when I was in China, much of these kind of metaphors are sort of absent. It sort of bakes so much into the culture because they've been around so long that you know that they, I mean, it's not a sexy climate like it is in America with, like, billboards and everything. But the amount of sensuality and, you know, people holding children and, you know, everybody sort of, it's not like a copulative fever thing going on. It's just sort of a norm to want to bring children into this world and create another generation. Well, now you've got this huge, you know, continent, region of China that was united, say, 2,200 years ago. And now, you know, it's a force to be contended with. So, you know, the red dragon now is the black dragon. You know, it's gone from being in the red to being in the black. I quote Rush on that, but that's a good line. And what has happened is that when it comes to, you know, ennobling or blazing some sort of firmament of truth, you know, those things are sort of found in their constitution. You know, it's like the Communist Party today has had to come up with some sort of means of balancing rational with irrational. So they give credit to spiritual domain within their constitution without using the name of God, right, to create some sort of ability to allow people to practice what they believe. But it's still the issue that, for some reason which you have to understand about this cultural identity, they need to present all is, you know, one is for all and all is for one. And so therefore, this idea of sharing everything and becoming part of this complicated, like, jungle gym of support is what makes business there so difficult to accomplish, because you don't know who's holding on to who when you want to cut the check. You know, at the very end they go, oh, we got five more people in the line. I said, so why didn't you tell me when we started this darn deal? Now you want to change everything. So a lot of deals fall apart because in the very end they, you know, they grab five more friends who have to be part of the deal.
Right.
You know, you go to a meeting, there's five, and at the end of the meeting they're like 50. It's like, where do all these people come from? It's the sort of feeling you got. And that's what they do. It's like everybody wants to be part of something. So it's certainly not from Harvard. You know, we don't teach this stuff at Eaton School of, you know, Business. But you get the idea that they are having to reconstruct their social order on the nature of business, even though everybody wants to use their, you know, their land and their facilities and their craftsmen. The fact of the matter is, it's not good enough. You know, it's just not good enough. People pay through the nose to create industry there, you know, because banks just, you know, cut a good deal and everybody's happy.
Right.
You know, but what it comes down to right now is most people ask me when I returned, is like, is China a threat? And of course China feels they're doing a noble thing by going into countries that we can't go into because of our democratic, you know, I won't say lily livered, but I will say, you know, liberal, not passionate conservative. I'm getting tired. What's the opposite of passionate conservative? Rush. We were talking about the sort of
sensitive liberal.
Yeah, neoliberalism, maybe, but.
Well, the fact is, in China, you know, there is really supposed to be only one way. So it's not really a two-party system, which is sort of weird. How do they do anything? Everybody all agrees on one thing. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that when it comes right down to it, they are not considered a threat based on the fact that they go about their business, you know, in a righteous way, right? But they use the power of their force to exhibit paternal, caring methods, whereas what we do as a democracy, we try to create an ideal form, you know. So, you know, the bleeding heart liberal versus the compassionate conservative is the same sort of issue in China where, you know, the bleeding heart liberal are people who want to talk about things, and the government says there's no room for that. You know, we don't really need to hear your voice on this. You know, it goes against the norm. So, you know, things that deal with freedom of speech and religion are treated with what we would call not a lack of respect, but it just doesn't seem so important, you know. It seems a form of anarchy to be able to speak up and voice your truth. So, where does it end, you know? If they're going to go into the Sudan, and if they're going to go into Tibet and Burma, you know, they have just created their own new world order.
Mm.
And it was in the, I'll conclude this by saying that, you know, in the ChinaDaily.com.cn, they did openly say that they are creating their new world order, but it'll be different than Bush's, right?
Mm.
Or, you know, it'll have a different thing than the neocons. Well, it apparently suggests that the whole planet from, you know, east to west will be under a realm soon enough of, you know, controlling empire kind of influences.
Do you think that will be allowed to happen, or do you think that something will happen?
It's not allowed. It's happening now.
Yeah, but I mean,
Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, they're all going to be under the tutelage, or whatever you want to call it, the graceful arms or whatever, of the Red Dragon.
Okay.
You know? And that's just the way it's going to have to be, because they announced it, so it's going to happen. They have the largest army. They picked up Burma, you know, like picking up a basketball, you know, game. They just picked up the whole Burmese army. And, you know, they're basically trying to keep control of the region so that there's one form of balance and not, you know, the crazy things that are going on there now. You know, everybody is their own potentate. Everybody's controlling their own way. It just doesn't seem right. But China, in its own kind way, will moderate all that by showing its more paternal side. America has more of a maternal energy, you know. It's more, it conforms to what Rush and I have discussed much, is how America set the precedent for marketing in the world by having the woman lead. You know, she leads and men follow, so therefore that is the way of creating an economy, a market economy. Mm-hmm.
But in a true sense, neither one of them are showing any real love. I mean, the Chinese aren't treating their people with any dignity, and neither really are the Americans, frankly.
Well, yeah, but the problem with love, Mike, is that the country that was built on the idea of brotherly love, founded in the city of Philadelphia, is now so schizophrenic, it can't tell a difference between Seth and Horace. It can't tell a difference between the liberals who want to destroy the ancient kingdom and the conservatives who want to restore what they don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, until America can overcome its schizophrenia, you know, we're going to let everything go into the toilet.
Amazing.
We're basically, I mean, the Exodus was an event when people left their senses and they started to follow their books.
Right.
And then they lost it. And so we're in the same situation now. We have, you know,
but everything
traditions we don't follow.
Right, but everything we're talking about tonight indicates that that is about to end, correct?
No, what it says is that it's time to begin.
Or that there's an opportunity now.
Well, it just says there is an awakening. I mean, when you get your buildings knocked down, you shouldn't say, we shouldn't have upset them. They wouldn't do that if we upset them. You know, the bottom line is, if you want a culture that believes in getting to heaven by killing, all right, then you don't go to Philadelphia.
Right.
You know, and our country was founded on, you know, a belief that a consensus will work. And you don't have to have a dogmatic law to force the people to come to a consensus.
Mm.
And in China, the situation in China is just, it's pure economics. It's just total volume. And it's a situation, you know, where the Americans have to realize, okay, we lost our virginity back in 9/11. The question now is, will we grow up or go on being teenagers?
Right, right. How are we going to move forward? Hmm.
Right. Then that, and on this last note, when you look at the younger generation in any culture around the world, they are left sort of strapless, you know. They don't seem to have the same feel. They've been pulled away from the family unit, so therefore they're like our Gen Xers, right, in some ways. Their behavior is not as radical because they don't have as many toys. But they're out really working, I swear, they're working 7 days a week. They're like slaves of the youth system to have prominence and have money. You know, if they don't have a sugar daddy or rich boyfriend, parents help them, but they got to work extremely hard to bring it up to scratch, you know,
right,
what we call scratch. So when you meet these people from 23 on, they're always working. They don't seem to have a free time until the season, if it's seasonal, gets quiet and they have more free time. And my point is that you know, the generosity of China is something that probably America went through in the 50s, 60s. Now, China has its right to display this kind of behavior because they never have. But they're going to destroy in 10 years what America did in 50.
Hmm.
And they won't have a chance to repair it in 3 when it took America 30. You know?
Right.
It took 30 years of my life to see, you know, water filtration getting improved and, well, air quality is better, you know, more pollution devices. And, you know, China is wickedly, like, out of control this way. They have cars with better, you know, modern, but they have no protocols. You know, they don't have a system whereby they can introduce some sort of lariat, you know, to control, you know, energy consumption. So maybe they'll say, okay, in 3 years, make sure all the cars are run on, you know, potato water or something.
Right.
You know, they haven't gotten there yet.
Oh,
but I could point out 2 good things. Steam has been, you know, Beijing, which people don't know, is on one of the largest geothermal sites in the world. It's got sulfur springs everywhere. Many people don't know that. And so the Icelandic geothermal project is on point to try to start building geothermal plants to take over where coal and oil doesn't make it. And the Danes have come in to build the massive turbine farms in plenty of space.
All right, look, Bruce, I'm sorry. We're going to have to cut it, though.
No problem.
And Rush, thank you both so much. It's been amazing, as I imagined it would. I can't wait to go back and listen to this thing again. I've got a bunch of people sending me emails saying I need to listen to that again, but thanks for doing the show. So There's a lot of information here, as there always is when I talk to Bruce and people like yourselves. So thanks for spending the time, and we'll...
Welcome.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Mike.
It's been a pleasure, and we'll try to do it again as this whole thing keeps unfolding, all right?
Yeah, and let's remember that flower tonight, opening up and ready to close at sunrise.
How about it, Bruce?
Okay, bro. Thank you so much.
Thanks, y'all.
All right.
Everybody, Bruce, Raphael, Mr. Rush, Allen, thanks so much for being with us tonight. We'll get this program up and on the web and the archives as soon as possible, and you can check it out again and give it a good listen in the privacy of your own home. Share it with other people if you think it's reasonable, okay? All right, we got Ruth coming up with Crash Landing in just a couple minutes here. We'll finish things off with one more song here from Calhoun. And just let me mention, Brian Trent will be on the program next week. Brian was on the show sometime last year. He's the author of Remembering Hypatia, among other books. He's wonderful, great author, and a guy I really like to talk to. So join us next week, Brian Trent, and we'll do it up again, okay? The week after that, Dennis McKenna and Jay Widener coming up, Bruce Lipton, a lot of good stuff, all right? Anyway, thanks again for listening to the program. Thanks to Bruce and to Rush for joining us one more time, and thanks to all you for listening. Okay, it's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Stick around. We've got Ruth, Crash Landing, good music coming up for the next few hours.
Gonna work it out. It seems unreal, but this will heal.